chairperson of the Select Committee on Economic and Business Development. The Department of Labor is one of the six departments that this committee oversight. It's the Department of Labor, Department of Transport, Department of Public Works, Department of Energy, Department of Small Business Development. Yeah, I think there are six, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah, those that have counted. But we have 81 entities altogether, which are entities of the six departments. I'm also trying to buy time as they are connecting, but I'm also concerned about the minister and to also attend the cabinet committee meeting. Let me start this by the Honorable Mteto.
My name is James Nkosi Mteto. I'm a member of this committee from the province of KwaZulu-Natal.
I'm Sherilyn Dudley, member of the African Christian Democratic Party, and a visitor today. Thank you.
Good morning, Honorable Chair, Minister, members, colleagues from the Department of Labor. My name is Eddie Makue, and I represent the province of Gauteng.
Dumela, ke matsako de khale, gae ke mola province ya Limpopo. Ke lebo.
Good morning, my name is Vusi Magwebo from the Eastern Cape. Thank you.
Good morning, my name is Willem Faber and I represent the Northern Cape Province.
Thank you very much. We then the department, the minister, and the official.
My name is Mildred Oliphant. Currently deployed as the Minister of Labor. Thank you very much.
Good morning. My name is Bahumi Matelisi. I'm the DGG Corporate Services, but I'm currently acting as the DG.
Good morning. My name is Matapela Matabuke from the Office of the DG.
Good morning, Temingo Simkaliki. Department of Labor.
Morning, Major Guadipatera, Department of Labor.
Good morning, my name is Debo Hotejani. I'm the Chief Communication Officer of the Department of Labor, and I'm here acting as the Chief Operations Officer today.
Sorry, good morning. My name is Greg Schneeman. I'm from the Office of the Minister.
Good morning, Chair. My name is Michael Prince. I'm from Parliament Legal Services.
Good morning, Chair. My name is Fatima Ibrahim. I'm also from Parliament Legal Services.
Good morning, Chairperson. My name is Mohamed Kweta from the Office of the Chief Legal Advisor.
My name is Eric Nyagamba from the Office of the Minister.
Good morning, Chairperson. My name is Marikole Nhleki from the Office of the Director General.
Good morning. My name is Nosuke Wotinizulu, the Secretary.
Good morning. My name is Lutu Mutashua. I'm the Coordinator of the Committee.
Good morning, I'm Mr. Erasmus from Parliament.
My name is Lieutenant Richard from the Minister.
loud.
Good morning, I'm Shumara. I'm from Procedural Services in NCOP.
Morning, everybody. Ismail Hussain, PNG.
So we know who's here. Thank you very much. The apology that we've received from our side is that of an honorable launch. We have not received an apology from Honorable Fowler. I've not seen him this year. I don't know whether there's any problem, but it's a matter that will follow up. I've been made aware that from the Department of Labor, when I spoke to the minister yesterday, that the DG is out of the country, applies on what introducing herself as acting DG. And I think also the deputy minister is also out of the country. The minister has indicated that today is a cabinet committee meeting, but she has availed herself, but she will, after having made the opening remarks, she has to be excused so that she can attend the cabinet committee meeting. At this stage, then I give to the minister to make opening remarks. As I indicated, then later we allow Honorable Dudley, who I think should to also attend the committee meetings after every meeting. I don't know if you spent the whole day for this committee. They'll indicate. No, you can. It's up to you. You can be here for the whole duration. Over to you, Minister.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and honorable members, and the officials from the department and also from Parliament. Firstly, let me just indicate why the Deputy Minister is out of the country. He's attending ARLAC. It's one of the labor, employment, and social security structure that we participate in the AU, and they are having that session in Swaziland, and the Director General is attending the G20 technical team meeting that is preparing for the G20 in Argentina. And is one of the structures also that we participate in as the Department of Labor. And that team who is preparing for the meeting of the Ministers of Labor, Employment and Social Security. Chairperson, as you have indicated that I must introduce the discussions, particularly when it relates to the Labor Laws Amendment Bill. That program arises from the proposal that was presented by through the members, private members legislative proposal by Honorable Dudley from the National Assembly. And the proposal was the inclusion of all people who are contributing, particularly when it comes to the benefits for surrogate mothers, and also when it comes to parental benefits in relation to paternal. And I do believe that it was only, we're saying maternity benefits excluding the paternal benefits, but also the issue of the adoption benefits as well. But I must indicate that when it comes to the issues of paying the adoption benefits, already the Unemployment Insurance Fund is paying that benefit. So, and the other issue was in relation to the error that was made during the final drafting of the Unemployment Insurance Bill, where it was indicated that in terms of the maternity benefits, it's going to be 17, either stroke or comma 32, instead of saying the benefits will be paid on for 17 to 32 weeks. So that was the correction that we have also put in that particular proposal. But the officials, through the acting director general, particularly Mr. Mkalipi, who leads these legislative proposals, particularly when it comes to NEDLAC discussions, will fully brief the committees in details on those particular issues. And then the other ones is in relation to the National Minimum Wage Bill, Labor Relations Amendment Bill, and the Basic Conditions of Employment Bill. On those particular ones, Chairperson, firstly, let me start with the issue of the Labor Relations Amendment Bill. That one emanates from the discussions that were held at a national level under the leadership of President Jacob Zuma then. And that arises from what was happening in the workplace. And in terms of the government program, we have a 9-point plan that deals with the moderating conflicts in the workplace. So the discussion, therefore, came out with various proposals. One of them emanates from the National Framework on Peace Agreement that was signed by all social partners who were participating in that forum, particularly organized labor through the three federations and the relevant trade unions then that were affected by the conflict in the workplace. And that was held in 2013, arising from what happened in Marikana in particular. And also, it was informed by the peace agreement that was signed by the social partners, particularly the trade unions, in Rustenburg in 2013 as well. So those agreements then were put in the Code of Good Practice that was adopted by the NEDLAC social partners structure that we're discussing the issues of the national minimum wage on how we have to deal with the challenges that faced by the employees and the employers during the bargaining process. But when it comes to the national minimum wage itself, legislation, it is informed by the proposed agreement, of which we said it should guide us on how we have to implement the modalities when it comes to the national minimum wage. As you well aware, I think we informally briefed the members that one, in terms of the national minimum wage, the social partners agreed on how we have to implement that, and therefore we have agreed that we need to have a legislation that will be guiding us. But when it comes to the issues of why we have the national minimum wage as a country, we said, one, in terms of what is happening in the country, we have inequality that is still a challenge. And therefore, also when it comes to the issue that has to deal with the wage gap between the workers that are employed in various areas but doing the same job, we need to come up with the equalization. In terms of the employment equity, that also addresses some of the issues that are part of the reason why today we have a national minimum wage. But all those details are going to be presented to you through the acting DG by Mr. Mkalipi, and also to indicate that all the social partners at NEDLAC particularly business and organized labor. They have agreed in terms of the amount that should be paid the starting point of the national minimum wage, and also we're going to have a commission that will be reviewing on a yearly basis whether there is a need to increase the national minimum wage based on the conditions of that particular child. But I must indicate, Chair, that the national minimum wage is not a living wage per se, because our understanding is that when you talk about the living wage, the living wage is based on the conditions of that particular time, and therefore we said let us strengthen and promote the collective bargaining so that both employers and employees must continue to negotiate on the conditions of work in the workplace, and also looking at the wages of the workers in this country. But also I must indicate that we have agreed on the exclusion, particularly when it comes to certain categories, of which the officials will give you the details on that. And also we have agreed that in terms of the expanded public works program, we should still continue implementing the sectoral minimum wage. But also, there was an agreement on which level we should pay those that are part of the EPWP. And I must also indicate that in terms of the law, the Expanded Public Works Program is a program for 2 years, not more than that, because it was started as part of training people on certain categories at a lower level. And therefore, that is why we're saying that should be excluded and to continue to be paid under the sectoral determination. And Chairperson, also I think what we need to understand as well is that when we talk about the national minimum wage and the proposals that came in, all social partners had the opportunity to do their own research. And also the government did its own research, and that's why we ended up agreeing on the figures that we have agreed to. And therefore, Chair, we have agreed also that we need to implement the national minimum wage by the 1st of May 2018. But we have emphasized as the government that it will depend on the finalization of the legislation, because whatever we have to do, it should be within the legislative framework. And that's why the bills are before Parliament. And I know that there will be questions that why did we submit the legislation? It's either late, it was submitted in November through the joint rule 159. And then we have requested the presiding officers that as Parliament should decide on how they have to deal with the legislation, because we can't dictate to Parliament. So it's out of our hands as government. It's now before the committees, and then the committees will decide on how they're going to deal with those legislative proposals. But I must say, Chair, if we successfully finalize the legislation and promulgated by the President, then we'll be able then to implement the national minimum wage. Thank you very much, Chair.
Yeah, thank you very much, Minister. It's like you help with the whole presentation. But we'll allow the Deputy DG and Mr. Mkalipi, as you indicate, to perhaps give us more detail. Let me also explain that we have two processes here, honourable members. One is the unemployment insurance fund, the private members bill. We'll be getting a briefing from Honourable Dudley and also from the the department will also make comments. That one, it has been passed by the National Assembly. So that's why I'm saying there are two processes. So we will then, the only thing here is that we have brought them all together so that there's one presentation on all of them. Otherwise, we could have separated them. We could have had a briefing by the Department of Labor for labor law reform. And then perhaps later, we have a presentation on the unemployment insurance fund. Yeah, they are all Section 75 bills. But what then happens that normally we wait, like we have done with the private members bill. We waited for the National Assembly and its committee, the portfolio committee, to deal with those processes. Take the bill after the committee had considered it to the National Assembly chamber for adoption. They passed the legislation, but now it's our turn to receive the briefing on the legislation. After that, then we'll deal with the processes of submission by the stakeholders. Now, the difference with the national minimum wage is that already there's an implementation date. Now, what it means, we decided, like we indicated last week when we were dealing with the ARTO bill, that instead of waiting for the National Assembly to pass that bill, we decided that we'll also get involved in those processes. Like today we're getting the briefing. When I check with the NA portfolio committee, they have advertised now, I think they're allowing for a three-week period for the submissions, and after that then they will consider those submissions, written submission, and decide on the public hearings or oral submissions. Once they're done with that, we won't wait for them then to go to the National Assembly Chamber to adopt or pass the bill. We'll also follow up with the similar processes where we advertise as well as the NCOP, and then we also deal with the same processes. So we will have those two separate ones, because this one has already been passed by NA, so we'll soon after the briefing, we will then advertise and continue. There could be a difference maybe of a week or 2 weeks, depending on how the NCOP program deal with them. But after we have considered them, then the programming whip will then program it for consideration by the chamber of the NCOP. I just wanted to clarify that now that we are having all of them, the presentation of all of them at once, it doesn't necessarily mean we will deal with them in terms of the processes the same way. So in one committee meeting, we may deal with the unemployment insurance fund, the submission only on the unemployment insurance fund. And in another meeting, we deal with the submission on the labor laws reform, the national minimum wage, the BCEA, and the LRA amendment bills. So I just wanted to clarify before we allow Honorable Dudley to make presentation, and then later then the department make a presentation on the labor law reform. Thank you, Honorable. Over to you, Honorable Dudley. Minister, you just indicate whenever you're ready to listen.
Shall I speak from here? Thank you. Good morning, and thank you very much for the privilege of being able to be with you today. I take it, if I can just get clarity, that the department are going to present on this legislation this morning?
What I said is that perhaps you can use this and then maybe talk to the presentation that is here.
Yeah, but will they further?
But then they will make comments on the
presentation. But they won't actually present on it? So yeah.
They're not going to present except just to comment and also answer questions of
all
members,
right, so we can go
together with yourself.
So we can go through the presentation together.
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Richard, just to give a little bit of background as to how it came into being, obviously as a party, the African Christian Democratic Party, have a conviction that strong families build a strong nation, and so it's looking at ways that we can strengthen family, and obviously the Green Paper on Family was talking about this concept. It was also individual fathers who were not able to get back to when their wives were having babies, and it was just a lot of hardship around those things. And then also I heard a debate in terms of the unions speaking about the issue, and then got into consultation with the unions in terms of where workers stood on this issue and how important it was. And that was kind of, apart from that, I have... going on for 6 grandchildren, and I've got 4 children myself and having different births, and knowing just how important it is, that early bonding, and particularly in our country where fathers have been cheated out of being able to be in a position where they can bond with their children, and a lot of the difficulties we have because it's become a cultural norm for fathers to be kind of at a distance from their children. We thought this won't cure everything, but it seemed to be a good step in the right direction in terms of inviting fathers back into the role that is so importantly their role and only they can play. One of the issues, of course, right in the beginning was to make sure that the legislation was entirely lining up with present South African legislation, and that it would be constitutional. That was really important, and the concept of parental leave was then birthed because it helped cover the situation in terms of not creating any kind of discrimination, and no matter what the laws were at any given time, that would apply. So that was really important. It's been very exciting working on this work, and I think one of the things I'd like to just mention is at the time that it went through the National Assembly, there was a huge response, way bigger than I actually ever expected, and I kind of, you know, the euphoria we've just experienced around the new president taking office and that hope, I had that same kind of response come, and fathers were just so excited. And it's not really about the fact that they're going to gain any big monetary advantage. It's not that. They're actually going to gain that opportunity to make that decision for themselves, whether they're there, whether they're not there. And it will always be a sacrifice because you don't earn, you won't get exactly what you would have if you were earning. But I think the bigger sense was that fathers were almost feeling like they were being recognized as an important part of parenting, and we're delighted to be invited back into that role. So that was just as a kind of a sense that we are really on the right track, and the country is responding positively. So if we want to flip through just to present what is actually in the legislation. Is someone on it? Okay, so the Unemployment Insurance Amendment Act was signed into law in January 2017. The department realized that the Amendment Act has 2 errors that poses a challenge in implementing. The department approached the Portfolio Committee of Labor to include amendments on the 2 provisions, which errors identified in the Amendment Act. The amendment section 13 reads, 3A, subject to subsection, I'm going to see if this actually helps because it's very pale, it does, a contributor's entitlement to benefits in terms of this chapter accrues at a rate of 1 day's benefit, thank you. At 1 day's benefit for every completed 5 days of employment as a contributor, subject to a maximum accrual of 365 days benefit, in the 4-year period immediately preceding the day after the date of ending of the period of employment in terms of this chapter. Section 13.3a, during planning for implementation of the section, it was found that the ratio of 1 to 5, 1 credit equals 5 work days, results in 298 days instead of the required 365 days as provided for in the UI Amendment Act. So paying for 298 days will defeat the purpose of the amendment, since the fund will be unable to pay for 365. The intention is to pay benefits for a period of 365 days, and this can only be achieved with a lesser ratio. Thus, the provision was made. Section 24.5, a contributor who has a miscarriage during the third trimester or bears a stillborn child is entitled to a full maternity benefit of 17 to 32 weeks. And Section 24.5, during the planning for implementation of this section, it was found that the section refers to 17 to 32 weeks instead of 17, 32 weeks. This section makes provision for miscarriage benefits. The intention of this section is to align miscarriage benefits with maternity benefits as contemplated in Section 24.4. The intention of Section 24.5 was to bring alignment between miscarriage benefits and maternity benefits. The provision of 17 to 32 weeks instead of 17, 32 weeks has been was erroneously provided, so that was corrected. The Labour Laws Amendment introduces the following obligations to the fund: paying for parental benefits, paternal, benefits for surrogate mothers, adoption benefits, that you are if already paying the benefits there. Parental benefits are introduced as the result of a new provision that provides for 12 days paternity leave. The amendment bill also provides for leave to commissioning mothers, surrogacy, and related UI benefits. The fund is already paying for adoption benefits, and therefore any provision in the Labour Laws Amendment Bill will not have a negative impact on the fund. The difference there is, of course, that there was no legislation holding companies to having to give that leave. Surrogacy benefits will be paid similar to adoption benefits. The fund sourced an actuarial valuation to determine the affordability of all new benefits, including those in the Labour Laws Amendment Bill. The report indicates that the expenditure relating to the benefits introduced by the UI Amendment Act and the Labour Laws Amendment Bill will be affordable. It is recommended that the committee positively considers the amendments as they will be beneficial to the beneficiaries. So basically, I think that, you know, one of the things that has come up since the legislation was passed in the National Assembly was people trying to stir up the idea that fathers can then have a DNA testing, and so they can get their leave and then go and say that they reject the baby, which of course is getting really, really complicated. And there might be a need to link the fact that when a father takes responsibility in terms of putting his name on that birth certificate, that he does it knowing that whether or not he has a DNA test later on, he has taken responsibility for that child. And I think that would simplify that. Thank you. Happy to answer any queries anybody has, but obviously the department's in a strong position to do that as well.
Perhaps let me start find out from the department to you, acting DG, if there are any points that you of emphasis would like to make before I allow members to ask questions.
Thank you, Chair. We are fine.
We start with this one, members, if there are any questions on this amendment. I'll take hands. A straightforward presentation. I don't see any hands. So maybe after the submissions by stakeholders, and then we'll be able to deliberate. Otherwise, we so.
Just for the responsibility, you know, of getting a child to be related, if you're the
The actual bill has been sent honourable members. I saw Martinez emailed the actual bill. So when you have time, you can also go through the bill itself. maybe when we do the deliberation after the submission, you may be able to engage or participate in the deliberation. So I think we're fine with this one, and therefore, as I indicated earlier, the process now is that of issuing out an advert to invite submissions from the stakeholders, and then we'll, in our program, then we'll decide when we will be dealing with those submissions, you know, from the stakeholders. Thank you very much.
Just to thank you again and to wish you well with your deliberations and the hearings. Thank you.
Honourable Minister.
Thank you very much, Chair. And I just want to thank Honourable Dutton that he can really fit to be the official of the Department of Labour, particularly when it comes to the presentation of the legislation. But I must also clarify, Chair, that in fact, the UI amendment was signed by the President into law, but since there were those mistakes, now we are waiting for the finalization of the bill. Already the regulations have been discussed at NEDLAC, and immediately when the bill is finalized, then we will also send it to the President to request for the promulgation, so that we can be able to implement it. But also, I just want to clarify some issues, particularly when it comes to the benefits, because there was also a court judgment that was saying all the workers must benefit on maternity benefits. So what we want to clarify on that particular issue, Chair, is that only the beneficiaries, when it comes to beneficiaries, we are talking about those who are contributors to the fund. If you are not a contributor, you don't qualify. So we need to have a clear understanding on that one, that it's only those who are contributing that will qualify. Thank you very much, Chair.
Honourable Makul, before we go to the next presentation.
Thank you very much, Chair. Chair, the most vulnerable sectors amongst the working people are obviously the farm workers and the domestic workers. Can the department give us some indication? They are disorganized. Have you been able to consult with them, particularly in terms of the last remark that was made by the Honourable Minister about people that are not contributing? Because what we may find is that we have an intention and the employers within those sectors don't come along, and then those that are earmarked to be benefiting is still cut out of the system. Do we have some indication of where we stand as a country on that matter? Thank you, Chair.
I think in the bill itself, there's a section that deals with the application of the Act, but I'll allow the department so that I don't respond on their behalf to clarify. Acting DC or some currency.
I'll hand over to Mr. McCauley to respond to the question.
Chair, the issue of enforcement, because that's where this issue comes in. Remember, all workers in the country, in terms of the constitution, have got a right to fair labor practice. And the Unemployment Insurance Fund Act applies to all workers, and all workers are covered. What normally happens, and also the Unemployment Insurance Act put an obligation on employers, not on workers. Workers, in terms of the Act, workers don't have to contribute anything. But the employer must pay 2% of the worker's wage into the fund. And then the employer is allowed to deduct 1% from the employee. But the obligation is with the employer to make the contribution. Now, technically, if you look at that, if the employer, many times what happens is that employers deduct money from workers, but they don't send it to the fund. And then when workers go out and claim, they find out that they are not registered and there's no contribution in their name. That is a problem of the employer. It's a failure of the employer to submit the money sometimes even to register the workers. Now, the department carry blitz inspection from time to time. We've got a number of inspectors that go out and do inspection. We can't guarantee that inspectors will visit every factory in South Africa or every farm. But we depend also on the cooperation from labor and business and workers themselves indicating to the department where are the problems in terms of the areas that they are in. But in terms of the programs of the department and the inspection service that was carried out, it will be able to cover many areas in the farming sector and the domestic sector. Thank you, Chief.
Fine. You want to make a follow-up question?
I'll do my follow-up later, Chief. Thank you.
We're now dealing with the next presentation. Acting DJ.
Chair, I will once again ask Ms. Mukalipi to do the presentation. Thank you.
Go to bed.
As the minister has indicated, this bill comes from 2014 when the then president of the country, President Zuma, in his State of the Nation address, indicated that the deputy president of the country must lead a process that look at the modalities of minimum wage and the issues around stability in the labor market. This was followed by the discussion by the parties in Ekurhuleni, where they agree on a declaration containing practical steps and arrangement to promote labor market stability and the national minimum wage. And then it went to NEDLAC parties negotiated with them for quite a long time, from 2015 to 2016, and then an agreement was reached in 2017 between the parties, and then that agreement deal as with the minimum wage and the Labor Relations Act. And the bills were submitted, completed at NEDLAC in September 2017 and submitted to Parliament. In terms of the National Minimum Wage Bill, the BCA amendments, and the LRA. All bills, as I indicated, were submitted in November. The aim, as the Minister has indicated, is to have the bills operational by the 1st of May if we can. Now, the LRA come together with the Code of Good Practice on Collective Bargaining and Industrial Action and Picketing. This Code of Good Practice deals with the conduct, what conduct is accepted of workers and employers during industrial action is detailed in the code. And the code is intended to try and change behavior, that is behavior unbecoming of both parties, both labor and business, whether is it violence, whether is it intimidation, the code deals with those issues. And then the accord, which also come with the Labor Relations Act, deals with agreement by the parties where they commit themselves to act in a certain way, both bargaining council in terms of industrial action. Now, the national minimum wage which was engaged at NEDLAC, as I've indicated, it was agreed on and submitted to Parliament, and the intention for it to come into operation on the 1st of May. It's a flaw of rights. In terms of the national minimum wage, no employer is allowed to pay below the national minimum wage. It doesn't matter whether there's an agreement with the employees. It doesn't matter whether there's a collective agreement in the bargaining council. That agreement will be contrary to the law. The law makes it clear that nobody can be paid below the minimum wage. and the level of the minimum wage that was agreed is 20 rand in all sectors of the industry, except farm workers, which will be 90% of the 20 rand, which is 18 rand, domestic, which is 75% of the 20 rand, which amounts to 15 rand, and EPWP, which is 55% of the minimum wage, which amount to 11 rand. The other sector that is excluded is learners, who are everybody who is employed as a learner in terms of the Skills Development Act is excluded in the National Minimum Wage. There's a schedule in the National Minimum Wage Act which deals with the rates of learners as published in the sector examination. And unlike the LRA, the National Minimum Wage applies to all workers. This is very important. The LRA and the BCA, the BCA does not apply to all workers. It applies to employees. And the difference between workers and employees is that for an employee, there's got to be an employer and employee relationship. But for a worker, there's no need for an employer and employer relationship. If you, after the 1st of May, you ask me to wash your car, I'm not your employee, but I'm your worker because I'm washing your car. Therefore, the national minimum wage applies to you. That's the difference. Where there's an employer and employee relationship, it's clear the BCA, the Labor Relations Act dismissal come into play. But the national minimum wage will apply to all workers, irrespective of whether they are employed permanently or volunteer. It excludes volunteers who are not expecting to receive payment. Now, there's a big confusion in the labor market about volunteers. You've got volunteers who are volunteering because of lack of jobs. People who volunteer in the public sector and do all sorts of jobs. You've got people who are CEOs who volunteer to do free work without expecting to be paid. Those people who do not expect to be paid are excluded. There's a thin line between those who are exploited and regarded as volunteers, but they are not volunteers, and those who are genuine volunteers who give their time for free. Those then who give their time for free for charitable work are excluded. As I've indicated, no contract of employment can vary the national minimum wage, whether by agreement or even the minister can't publish anything contrary to the national minimum wage in terms of the agreement. And the national minimum wage, I mean, there's been a lot of discussion before the national minimum wage was announced that a national minimum wage is 20 rand, and there was then something about 3,600. People saying that it's 3,600 rand a month. There's no monthly rate for national minimum wage. It's an hourly national minimum wage. The amount of hours that you work, you get paid for those hours. Therefore, if you work 100 hours, you've got to be paid. Although the BCA limits working hours, you can't work 100 hours. Just making an example, if you work 100 hours, then you must be paid 20 rand for those 100 hours. There's no limit that how much you should be paid. And there's a big issue here where people wanted to have 3,600 as a monthly wage. The problem with that was that if you've got a limit of 3,600 as a monthly wage, then people who work for 45 hours will earn less than people who work 40 hours, because 3,600 is for people who work 40 hours. But for somebody who work 45 hours, it becomes 3,900. And that's the reason that it's purely 20 rand an hour. It excludes all payments in kind, like transport. If an employer pays you for transport, the employer can't say, well, I'm going to pay you 15 rand because I'm deducting 5 rand for transport. It excludes food. If you stay in the farm, and the house and your food that you get paid, the employer can't say, well, I'm paying you less than minimum wage because I'm giving you food. Any payment on card, your food tips in the restaurant. We know members here go to restaurant, they eat in restaurant, they tip very well as members. And in many restaurants, the owners of the restaurant then pay workers those tips, not the wages that they should earn. Now, we say you can't, if a worker does not make enough tips, you can't then say your wages is reduced because you have not made enough tips. Bonuses and gifts are excluded from the national minimum wage. it makes also provision for the minister to make more exclusions. This is important because, as you know, employers restructure their salary package many differently. I mean, all of you will remember when you were working maybe 20 years ago, there was nothing like total cost to common. You were paid your salary and it included everything. Now, there's a total cost to common. The common says, here's the salary. From that salary, you pay your medical leave, you pay your pension fund, you pay everything. That restructuring of employers is intended to reduce cost for employers. And what this provision allows the minister is that when employers introduce other systems that undermine the national minimum wage, the minister must be able to act and protect the national minimum wage by introducing regulations that exclude those attempts that erode the minimum wage. And as the minister also indicated, it will be reviewed annually, the national minimum wage. Labor has fought hard on this issue. Labor wanting a guaranteed adjustment, that there must be a guarantee adjustment. And the agreement that was reached at NetLabor was that no, the committee that is set up, the National Minimum Commission, must consider factors like inflation, wage levels, the growth of the economy, the productivity, employment levels. And if the economy is doing badly, they might say that the national minimum wage must not be increased. We don't know. But what is important is that as part of their process, when they review the national minimum wage, they need to make sure that it does not affect negatively poverty, and it does not reduce, it does not increase poverty. And they must make sure that the national minimum wage is protected, the value of the national minimum wage is protected, because you don't want a minimum wage that is 20 rand today, and then it's not reviewed for 15 years, for 5 years. In 5 years' time, it's worth 10 rand, because inflation has eroded it. That's why they needed to make sure that they protect the value. And the commission will be made out of three representatives from business, from labor, and from community. This is the first time community organization will be involved in setting wages, because the community sector fought very hard at NetLab for them to be included in the commission that will decide what the national minimum wage going forward. Now they are included. They were not included in the Basic Condition of Employment Act Commission that work on sector nation. The terms of the time frame for the commission will be 5 years in office, and the Director General has been requested to make sure that he or she provide the necessary funds and secretariat for the commission to be able to operate. We're already busy. We're hoping that we are going to publish regulations, because the law allows that the minister must grant exemption for those employers who are not able to afford. And the minister must publish regulation concerning those, and we are busy with those regulations, and we are going to publish those regulations before this law becomes a law, and we'll publish them in terms of the BCA, because the BCA allows the minister to publish regulations, because in order to make sure that by the 1st of May we are ready, we've got to be working on the regulation even before the law, and then we'll use the loophole of the BCA, where the BCA allows presently the law that the minister can introduce regulation dealing with any issues affecting the BCA, and we'll publish them for public comment so that society can comment on the regulation that will affect and see whether they meet the requirement. But the most important thing is that the law allows employers to only apply on affordability. If they don't afford, they can't apply if they afford. If they are not going to get exemption if they afford the 20 rand. The issue about the schedule to the minimum wage containing wages for of farm and domestic workers, as well as the definition of workers in the EBWP, is also included there to deal with the issues of confusion around all of these areas. That's the minimum wage. Now, the minimum wage and the BCA members talk to each other. The minimum wage sets the levels. The commission, the BCA deal with enforcement. Therefore, the enforcement of the minimum wage is in terms of the BCA, and that's why we do them together, because they talk to each other. We're making changes in the BCA to, as I said, to make sure that we strengthening enforcement of the national minimum wage. The issue of the definition in the BCA should be aligned to include the National Minimum Wage Act. We've made that amendment. We've made also an amendment in the BCA to indicate that no worker will be paid less than 4 hours. We've got a guaranteed 4 hours. If you employ me, you can't employ me for less than, you can employ me for less than 4 hours, but then you must pay me for 4 hours. If, for example, I come to work today and I arrive at the Department of Labor, and then power goes away, and then we've got load shedding, and then the department says, I must go home because I can't work. It means that even if the department asks me to go home in the first hour, they must pay me for 4 hours. As long as I am below 40 rand an hour. For those civil servants who are here, they earn above the 40 hours. Therefore, the 40 rand, therefore, the 4 hours does not apply to them. It only applies to all those workers that earn below 40 hours. They've got a guarantee. And this is purely to make sure that because workers travel from Khayelitsha to come and work here in Parliament, now they spend money on the train, on the bus to come here, to be told when they arrive here that you must go home, you work for only 1 hour, we'll pay you 20 rand. When they paid for their taxi fare, 20 rand coming here and 20 rand coming back. That's what the guaranteed working hours is for, to compensate workers for the cost that they incurred coming to work. If the employer inform workers today, phone them today and say, you don't have to come back to work tomorrow because there's a breakdown of machinery here, then that 4 hours goes away.
No.
The employer doesn't have to pay because the worker has not incurred any cost, and the employer has informed them in advance. If a farm who pick up workers in Khayelitsha to go work in the farm does not pitch up, and the workers are asked to go and wait for the farm in the station, and then for whatever reason, it comes out it's raining, her cats and dogs in the farm, and then the farmer can't go and pick up the workers. The workers are ready to be picked up. The 4 hours kicks in that. And that's what is driving. It's not only about the cost, because other people don't use taxes. They walk to work. There are few people who walk to work. It's not about the cost to compensate you for the transport. It's about the cost and the effort that you've taken to go to work to have that guarantee, and making sure that employers communicate to their workers if they don't have to come to work, they must be told well in advance that they don't have to come to work. That's what the guarantee is for. Now, the other change that we're making in terms of this, presently, in terms of the BCA, if an employer does not comply with the BCA or any of our legislation, that employer, that case goes to the labor court. We're changing that. We say it must no more go to the labor court, it must go to the CCMA for arbitration. We think that it's going to increase compliance with the law when it goes through the CCMA. And the proof of this is that those members who understand the labor market, bargaining council used that system already. They've been using that system since 1995, where all disputes about enforcement of their agreement are enforced through arbitration. And we did a research, a survey in all the bargaining councils and asked them what percentage of their cases that they've issued compliance or an arbitration awards on are reviewed in the labor court. And bargaining council could tell us that none, 0% of their cases. When they issue an arbitration award for compliance on condition of employment, employers comply. And we think the same is going to apply here. It's going to increase compliance from the CCMA to a different level when we go to the CCMA. And the enforcement includes all our legislation, UI, CC, conversation, it's included there. Now, in terms of the present act now, and we've made a proposal also that inspectors, if you earn more than the threshold that is published by the minister, the inspector are not going to be able to issue a compliance order. They can deal with your case if you earn as high as some of us are earning here, and then you earn enough to look after yourself and go to the courts and protect yourself. But everybody earning below the threshold, which is set at 205,000 by the minister, the inspector must be able to protect those workers. And a compliance order, if an inspector issues a compliance order and then an employer does not comply, the inspector takes that compliance order to the CCMA for the CCMA to make it an arbitration award immediately. And any person, including an employer, who fails, who dispute a compliance order, may pay a penalty. And the penalty that is structured, we structure the penalty differently. Normally in legislation, penalties go to fiscal. If you don't comply with the law and then you are penalized, the money goes to fiscal. And we know that the means of finance need as much money as they can get. But in this case, our proposal is that the penalties, if an employer does not comply with the law, the penalty that is issued must go to the employee. Because it's the employee who has lost the money, the opportunity cost to use the money, and we're changing the legislation in that sense that it must go to the employee, not the fiscal. The trade unions are allowed also present with this amendment to represent their members themselves. They don't have to come to the department now. Even workers themselves, they don't have to come to the department. They can go to the CCMA and put their case. Therefore, you have inspectors, you have the CCMA, trade unions, you have workers themselves who are able to go to the CCMA and put their case. The only disadvantage when the workers take a case themselves to the CCMA is that if an employer, as members would know, that all decisions of the CCMA and the minister and all of us here are administrative decisions, are challengeable in court. Any administrative decision is challenging in court. Therefore, if the CCMA gives you an award, an employer can go to the labor court to review that award. Now, if an employee go on his own or her own into the CCMA, and then the employer review the award to the labor court, then the employee bear the cost of defending that award in the labor court. But if the employee goes to the CCMA through the department, and then the employer take that award to the labor court, the department is responsible to ensure that the department fights the cost in the labor court. Therefore, when employees decide how to represent themselves, they've got to consider all of those issues, because the Department of Labor is not going to be able to come at the labor court when they're already at the labor court. If they want the Department of Labor to represent them up to the labor court, constitutional court, if it ends there, then the department must take up the case. But if they are confident of their case and they think that the employer is not going to challenge it, they can take it on their own. Those are the disadvantages that we are explaining to workers, that you are allowed to do it, but these are the risks when you take it. The issues about the amendment on the ECC, because now there's no commission, the ECC does not exist anymore. The commission, the National Minimum Wage Commission, will take over. We're making those changes. We've got transitional arrangement. I mean, there's been a lot of talk in the labor market where people were saying that what happens to the sector of designation now that the National Minimum Wage come into play. The transitional arrangement in the BCA, members will see, they state clearly that the BCA, the sector designation, remains legal instruments. They are enforceable. And an employer who does not comply with the sector designation will still be liable, and inspector will be taking up those cases. Therefore, the transitional arrangement deals with those issues. Now, the last presentation, the last process that we need to deal with in terms of the basic condition of employment is small changes that we're making on the time frames about undertaking and the compliance order. Presently, it's 21 days. We're changing it to 14 days. That an inspector must give an employer 14 days. If the employer does not comply with the undertaking, they must go to the CCMA. If they don't comply within 14 days with the compliance order, must go straight to the CCMA. And we've indicated that non-compliance is referred to the CCMA for compliance. And then The CCMA must certify the award as a CCMA award and enforce it. And the other issue is that we're saying that when the CCMA can award, it must include its cost, because the CCMA has got cost. If an employer does not comply with the national minimum wage, and then it goes to the CCMA, then the employer must know that it's going to pay the cost of the CCMA. The cost, what, how much does it cost the CCMA for the commissioner, the electricity, the infrastructure, everything? The CCMA will publish the cost if the employer loses the case in the CCMA. If the employer wins the case, that cost go away. But if it loses, the CCMA must include the cost of dealing with that case. The second thing that the CCMA need to make sure is that, remember the CCMA, when the CCMA has issued an award and the employer does not comply with that award, the CCMA is empowered to approach the sheriff of the court to enforce the award. I mean, the minister and the DG have been very generous to the CCMA, and we've been giving the CCMA R1 million every year extra from the budget that is passed by Parliament. Give the CCMA R1 million. And this R1 million is coming from all those workers who say they object, they are conscious objectors. They don't want their agency fee. In those sectors where there's an agency fee, they don't want their money to be sent to unions, because unions send the money to politics and all those issues. Then they say they object. That money, in terms of the present law of the LRA, must be sent to the Department of Labor. Now, we took a decision that said, what do we do with this money? And then we took a decision that this money must go to the CCMA. And we asked the CCMA, CCMA, assist all those workers who earn below the threshold to enforce their hour. And then what the CCMA does, it pays the security to the sheriff. Remember, when you go to the sheriff, the sheriff wants the security up front. And the CCMA must use that R1 million to pay the sheriff on behalf of all those poor workers who earn below the threshold to assist in the enforcement. The issue of the penalties that I've talked about, the penalties that we're introducing is, if you don't comply with the minimum wage, the inspector must add on the undertaking or on the compliance order 2 months' salary. Let's say the employee earns 4,000. You don't pay the minimum wage. The inspector must add 2 months' salary. That means 8,000 on top of what you owe the employee. Or the inspector must double the amount that is owed by the worker. Let's say you owe the worker for not paying the minimum wage for a year, you owe this worker 10,000. Then the inspector must double it to 20,000. That amount is a penalty for not complying with the minimum wage. All of that money goes to the employee. We want to encourage employees to come forward and give information, report cases, because they are going to benefit themselves if an employer is found not to comply with the national minimum wage. We having discussions, I mean, in the amendment, you see the amendment that is coming with the employment equity. We are busy, we are on the final stages of the employment equity amendment. In part of that amendment, we making arrangements to the implication, to the implementation of Section 53 of the Employment Equity Act. That section empower the minister to issue a certificate for companies who comply with the Employment Equity Act. Those who do not have a certificate won't be able to do business with the state. Now, where does the minimum wage come in that? The minister is not going to issue a certificate in a company that does not comply with the minimum wage. That's one of the requirements in terms of the Employment Equity Act. That's where the issue of doing business with government comes in. The second issue that we're doing to enforce compliance, we're having discussion with the National Treasurer to amend procurement regulation so that it be a requirement that a company who tenders in government must make an undertaking that says the price that I'm bidding for will enable me to pay the minimum wage. You don't want the situation that I put a price, a lower price than you. You don't get a tender. Then I've been able to lower my salary, my price, because I pay less. I don't pay the minimum wage. Now, if then it's a requirement that you make that commitment that you are able to pay the minimum wage, and then you don't pay it, it should be a reason to cancel that tender. And those are the enforcement provisions that we're trying to put on the table. We're discussing with the National Treasury. And the issue of attachment I've dealt with that, and that's the minimum wage members and the BCA. Now, the last bit of legislation that we talk about is the LRA, the Labor Relations Act. This to deal and stabilize the labor market. We're doing two things here, members. Stabilize and deal with violence and intimidation and strengthen collective bargaining. The first amendment that we're making amendment to Section 32 of the LRA, which deals with the extension of bargaining council agreement. Presently, Section 32 requires the minister, before the minister extends a collective agreement, she must consider representativity of both business, employer organization, and labor. And in many a time, the minister is challenged, taken to court. I mean, we've lost cases precisely on this issue of representativity. Because many trade unions, unfortunately, are losing members. And you find a situation that employer organizations employ the majority, but trade unions don't represent the majority. Now, what we're changing in the law, we say that the minister must be required to look on the representativity of any of the parties. If the employer organization employs the majority, it should be good enough for the minister to extend. If the unions represent the majority, it should be good enough for the minister to extend. And the reason for this is simple as this. If you work at Methodist Bank and you are a union negotiating in Methodist Bank and you represent 20%, only 20%, and Methodist Bank negotiate with you, accept you as a negotiating partner, and you sign an agreement with Methodist Bank for a minimum wage of $12,500. That $12,500, Methodist Bank does not pay to union members only. It pays to everybody in that company. If that's the extension. Methodist Bank extend that agreement to everybody. But that agreement has been entered between the company and the union that represents 20%. The reason Methodist Bank is able to do that is because all the workers are employed by Methodist Bank. The same applies in a sector. Now, we say, if employers in a sector employ the majority of workers in that sector, why shouldn't then the minister extend the agreement? Because employers employ the majority. And if trade unions represent the majority, even if employers employ the minority, if trade unions represent the majority, why shouldn't the minister extend the agreement? That's how we strengthen collective bargaining. We think that it will strengthen collective bargaining. And we've made changes so that the register can determine representativity and give a certificate. If the register gives a certificate today that you are representative, even if you lose your members 3 months down the line, that certificate will protect you for 12 months. And the other thing is that if you look at the metal industry, there's a big problem in the Metal Funding Council where there's no agreement on Providence Fund agreement, there's no agreement on the levy for bargaining council. And we're saying that you cannot have Providence Fund medical aid being used by both employers and trade unions as a negotiating tool for wages and working conditions, and they then collapse. And we're saying in order to protect that, the minister should be able to extend the operations of those funds that protect workers if the minister is requested by any of the parties. Therefore, NUMSA can come from the Metal Council after the 1st of May and say there's no agreement in the council for Providence Fund. But we want you, minister, to extend the operation of this agreement so that it does not collapse and it applies to all employees. And that is protecting collective bargaining and protecting social security benefit of workers. The next area, this is the area that, the first issue that I need to say, members, is that this area that I've dealt with, everybody, even at NetLink, NUMSA itself, they say this is progressive, want this, it must come. This is the area that they are not happy with, the area around picketing. What are we making a proposal for, members, is that you cannot go on strike if there are no picketing rules. No picketing rules, no strike. Just like you can't go on strike if there's no CCMA certificate. Therefore, what we're making a change on, we say that the CCMA, when the CCMA gives a certificate after the dispute has not been resolved, they must give roads immediately. Therefore, the certificate will go hand in hand with the roads from the CCMA. So that there's no interference with the right to strike, but you've got the roads. Now, if you don't comply with the roads, then there are consequences. You face the consequences. Your strike can be interdicted. If you don't comply with the rules, if you don't comply with the rules that have been set out, your strike can be affected. Or if the employer does not act in terms of those rules, the employer can be interdicted in terms of that. And the lockout may be stopped if the employer does not contribute. If we are going to publish what we call default picketing rules as part of this law, so that the commissioner can take those rules when they deal with disputes. What's going to happen is that those that understand the CCMA referral form 711, in that 711, an applicant must put in that form information about picketing. They must say how many workers will be picketing, what distance. You know that most of the time workers want to picket inside the factory. Employers want workers to picket far away from the factory, 1,000 meters from the factory. The workers want to be in, employers want them to be out. Now, what we're saying is that when you apply to the CCMA, then you supply that information. And then that information is sent to the employer. Employer put their information, and then the CCMA will determine immediately what should be done and issue a certificate with the rules. The next issue, when the CCMA deal with the rules, they've got to take into consideration the issues about the code of good practice on industrial action. We're making changes around the issues of minimum service level agreement. This is an issue about whether people can go on strike in essential services. This is a very serious issue. There's negotiation in the public sector now. We don't know where it might end up. And if there's no proper service-level agreement in hospitals, you might find a situation where people in hospitals are affected when you go out on strike. And we're making changes there to make it easy for the Social Service Committee to introduce a service-level agreement and amend them. We're making changes around the issues about the bylaws. Presently, the law requires that a union constitution must have provisions about bylaws. There's nothing new about that. That's what the law presents. But the problem is this. Union constitution, most of them, say a ballot will be done by a show of hands. Now, members will know that the word ballot presupposes that there's a ballot paper, there's a box, there's secrecy, those issues. You can't have a ballot. You can have a vote by show of hands, but you can't have a ballot by show of hands. And we're making changes to make sure that what do we mean by a secret ballot? That's the first thing. And there's no law that says that trade unions must ballot, but it says that trade unions must follow their constitution. If a union doesn't follow a constitution, the consequences of that is deregistration. That union is going to be deregistered by the register because it did not follow its constitution. Now, the law says that the constitution of the union must make sure there are provisions for a ballot, and those provisions for a ballot have got secrecy, they've got democracy, they've got protection for workers who vote differently. And you can see even in parliament, there are now fights about secret ballot and all of those issues. You know, it's the same principle that we're talking about here. and in terms of the law, they've got to keep the record. Presently, there's no requirement presently to keep the record for unions. And then when you ask, because the law doesn't allow them, does not ask them to keep record, they say they don't ballot and they don't have to keep record. We're making those changes to ensure that secret ballot means secret ballot and is carried before a trial. The next issue that we're making a change on is that the commission of the CCMA should be able to extend by at least 5 days a consultation. If the commission thinks that they need an extra day to solve this, presently, if 30 days come, commission has not had a choice, they must issue a certificate. We say that's not right. If the commissioner believes that if given another day, there will be a settlement here, why can't then the commissioner be given that extra day? That's what we're saying here. We're saying if the commissioner believes that they are close to a settlement, the only difference is that the parties need maybe another day to consider the issues that are on the table. And one of the parties does not want, the other party wants, then we're giving the right to the commissioner to be able to extend the 30 days to up to 35 days if need be. Now, this is another area, members, that is most of the unions who are outside NEDLAC, I must say, are not happy with the area around about advisory arbitration, where we say if a strike is violent and is protracted, the Minister of Labour should be able to approach the CCMA to set up advisory arbitration. Remember, it's advisory. You don't have to accept. They set up an advisory arbitration award. But then what happens? If there's an award that says, let us say in this company, the union wants 20%, 30% increase. The company says we can only afford 5%. The arbitrator look at it and says, we think this company can afford 8%. And the company agrees. Let us say that the union then, the commissioner issued this award. Then the parties have got 7 days to decide whether they accept or not. If they don't accept, the union can't just say we reject the award. They must have another secret ballot. There are two secret ballots. There's a secret ballot before going on strike. There's a secret ballot to decide whether the workers reject or accept the application award. If workers reject the application award, the strike continues. Nothing stops the strike. And the arbitration award, the arbitration does not stop the strike itself. The next issue that we're making also, we will be discussing with the NEDLAC parties to give us 20 people, and give us experts. Business will give us 20, labor will give us 20, and then we'll publish them. In case there's a union that does not want to participate in the arbitration, then we'll take from that list for them to put a position of a union in the arbitration so that we've got an award. The issue about the independence of the labor, of the register of the labor, of unions is entrenched in the law. The issue about transitional provision, what will happen? Because about 80% of the unions don't have provision for secret ballot in their constitution. Now, what is going to happen when this law becomes a law? And this law deals with a transitional arrangement where it says that for a period, the register must engage with those unions. The register must look at when is the next Congress and write a letter to them and say, in your next Congress, you must amend your constitution to make sure that it complies with the law. And if they fail to do that, then the only tool that the register has is deregistration in terms of this. As I've indicated, the issue of the Code of Good Hope, it provides guidance. We want this to be the tool in the labor market on the conduct. It talks about what to carry, the issues about not carries, whether you should be able to carry not carries, whether you should, what conduct you should have during industrial action. It talks about workplace democracy, the picketing. It talks about good faith bargaining. What is good faith bargaining? What do these parties need to do to ensure good faith bargaining? The accord is an accord that will be signed by labor, business, CETAS, government, that indicates that the parties are committed to the to implement the code of good practice and follow the law. And the CCMA will sign the same accord where it commits itself to train workers and employers on the code and make sure that all workers understand what action can they be allowed to take during industrial action and what action are not allowed. Thank you very much. members.
Thank you very much. Yes, it was a comprehensive minister.
Thank you very much, Chair. Before I leave, Chair, let me clarify the question that was asked by Honourable Member from Gauteng in terms of the vulnerable sectors registration with UIF, particularly when it comes to domestic workers. We have about 671,228 employees that have registered with UIF, and in terms of the employers that has registered with UIF, they are 693,252. But in terms of the stats, I think we still have a large number of both the employers and the employees that have not yet registered, because in terms of the stats, we have about plus minus 1 million domestic workers in South Africa. And also, I just want to add to Mr. Mkalipi, on the issues of the definition that we have put on the Basic Conditions of Employment Act, particularly vis-a-vis the employee and the worker, we have changed to define the worker based on the ILO resolutions. And I do believe that the members, particularly because in most cases now, you do have a representation to the ILC in particular, where these issues are being discussed under the Committee of Standards. So we have taken that route to use the ILO resolution. And I also want also to emphasize on the issues of the exemptions. Currently, we do have regulations that guide us on how we have to deal with the applications on exemption. We don't deal with the exemptions as a group of employers. Each individual employer must apply. And then currently we have the guide that says if the employer applies for the exemption, one, they must submit the 2 years financial records. Two, they must also indicate on how they are going to improve as the company in the next 2 years, and also they have to come up with a submission where the workers from that particular company have signed the agreement, all of them, to sign that they have agreed with the employer on how the employer is going to pay them the whatever increase that has been agreed upon when that company has started to improve their status as a company. Because at the end of the day, it doesn't mean that if you apply for exemption, you will not pay the workers altogether. You must have a plan and say, how are you going to pay them up until you pay the whole amount of money that is owed to the workers. And thank you very much, Chair, and I believe that you will now allow me to go as I said. Thank you very much.
No, thank you very much, Honourable Minister, for coming and also giving directions on these labor laws. Members, there are any questions or clarity? Your turn. No turns. Honorable Mshanga, Honorable Makue, Honorable Fafa, Honorable Makwehu, and Honorable Mchebe, Honorable Kod. In that order.
Okay, thank you, Chair. Chair, I just wanted to first have to be clarified on the issue of voluntarism of this advisory board, that these companies can enter into an agreement to acknowledge this advisory board. What informed you to say this is advisory? And in my take is that in any in government institutions or any other institution, whether it's private or what, if you say something is voluntary, it would then depend with the company's willingness to enter in that agreement. Now, I just want to know, why don't you do it as an obligator? Why should it be voluntary? That is the first question, Chair. The other one, Chair, these companies that do not comply, how do you monitor them? And why should they carry on operate while they don't comply? The third question, I will end it with that one, Chair. The issue of the labor hire issue. In one of the provinces, there's instances wherein there's an NGO that says government cannot employ without telling us as a labor hire, as an NGO, that how many people are going to employ in cross-cutting the department. We have an MOU signed with ourselves and the legislature that informs us to therefore employ for all other departments. How do you deal with this issue of labor hire? Because I think it has been said many times that we must try to limit their functions within the scrum of employment. That will be my three questions. I think the other one perhaps will give us the other one. Thank you, Chair.
What's the
The issue of picketing. There's Section 17 of the Constitution that allows each and every person to picket. There is Illegal Gathering Act. This amendment that we are proposing aligned with the aforementioned two documents. Thank you. Thank you, Chair.
Perhaps I should have also given a guide the National Minimum Wage Bill, BDA, and LRA amendment. Perhaps if a person can indicate the advisory, so I can't even know which one you're referring to. Honorable Mark West.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'm having a problem with Mr. Mkalipi, that he was very good in the way in which he dealt with the content, the legislative content of that. So I have no questions in that field. My questions, however, would be related more broadly, particularly if we look at the national minimum wage, and you're talking about the commission, and then you've given us an indication how the commission would be put together. But there needs to be some regulation that informs the operations of that commission. So two questions. Has the regulations been drafted? And second is, will those regulations be coming to us, or will the minister just gazette it? Not that I have a problem with either one of the two, but just so that I know where we're going. Because the B part of that question is related to, I'm not going to ask for the detail, but just to say, has the process of appointing the commissioners already started? My second question, Chair, would be, and I only have two. I'm listening to the very helpful information that you're giving. And then I put my hand in my own bosom. And I say, if I, as a member of parliament, don't understand these things, I can't expect that person that's employing a domestic worker to understand them. And thus my question is, are you thinking of doing some education so that we don't just produce the legislation, but also helps people to understand the significance of it? You see, there could be a backlash towards the national minimum wage. But once you understand it and the way you've explained it, also the Labor Relations Act, and giving us the example of how the trade unions have responded. I'm not saying put that detail in an educational brochure, but I'm asking two parts of the question. Are you able to produce a brochure? And B, do you have money to do that? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. I think Faber stepped out quickly. Two things, really. On the national minimum wage, Mr. Mkhalipi, through you, Chair. This is interesting, this is exciting. We're really getting into where we should have been a long time ago, labor peace, fairness, and, you know, labor justice. I must commend you for this. But I always worry when you have beautiful legislations, because in South Africa, sometimes we don't need more legislations, we need more implementation. We don't need more institutions, but we need more leaders to make what we have to work. Otherwise, we end up duplicating. That's the biggest problem. Here, for instance, on the minimum wage, you're talking about exemptions, which is beautiful. People who cannot afford the minimum wage, those employers, then they can apply for exemptions, to the department, and each case will be dealt on its own merits, right? Now, here is my problem. I haven't heard you telling us what is the criteria that makes one qualify for exemption. You need to be clear on that, because one is sitting at home, and in a country of lots of unemployment, those domestic workers, most of them are employed by grannies who are probably living on social grant or living on meager salaries, from their previous working life. They may not afford the minimum wage, but they still help South Africa to get going, create employment. So they'll come to you to say, this lady is working for me, she's staying me at the back of my house in the seventh quarters, we share the meals, we stay together every 30 days, she goes home. I'm trying to be practical here, because that's the reality of South Africa. She stays with me, this lady is my domestic, she uses my water, my lights, and my groceries, but I'm an old lady, I enjoy the company, so she's like a sister to me. But I cannot afford the minimum wage, and therefore I'm asking for exemption. So you need to have a clear criteria for like a threshold. If you look at other institutions, they'll quickly put a figure to say, below this threshold, you qualify for an exemption. I'm just making an example. Or on and above that, these are further criteria. So all that information must be there so that we know your exemption criteria. I would want to hear you on that. If you have that already, to share with us. If you don't, do you understand my worry now? And what are you going to do about it if you're not there yet? Because we are talking about 1st of May on implementation, and people are going to come to you for exemptions, and then you're going to say, then you're going to have a problem if you're not ready. That's the first point. Second point, quickly, Chair, is on the issue of the LRE, the amendment. Now, you're saying the conciliation day, you want to push it from 30 to 35 days, where you see that there could be a possibility of conciliation, the 30 days to 35, right? Now, I don't understand this. I'm worried about this again. You know, we cannot keep pushing the goalpost. 30 days is a reasonable period. And if we cannot conciliate, then we must move to the next step. We cannot keep opening up the bracket. In law, they will say 14 days, 7 days is a reasonable period for execution of this, of delivering the court papers and all that. But tomorrow, somebody can argue that 7 days is not a reasonable period. It must be changed to 10 days. Somebody may argue that 14 days is not a reasonable period, it must have changed to 17 days. Now, we can't get to the space of that. We have the processes, we've got steps that must be followed. Let's keep those steps small, otherwise we'll get to confusion. So I am worried about extension of the 30-day cycle. Keep it that way. If you can't conciliate, then what do we do? Arbitrate. If you can't do that, then those steps in terms of the labor law that must be applied in dispute resolution, let's stick to them and enforce them vigorously. Instead of just opening up the loop bigger and bigger, it causes a lot of, to me, I am still to be persuaded of the rationale of doing that, with due respect. Finally, I must commend you on the issues of the picketing, where now you are giving both parties, that is the employer and the employee, you're taking them to the space of natural justice, where each party now will have an opportunity to respond. The employees will say these are, as they apply for picketing, they will say these are the rules. That information will be there. The employer will be able to respond. Then they'll be able to make sure that there's a common understanding and agreement before the certificate of strike is issued. I accept that because the violence protest that we've seen, it was just exactly about that, where there was no clear rules or negotiated rules. One with ticketing at the door, pick and pay is not happy with that. Then there's frustrations. Tomorrow then there's violence and all that. So this is beautiful. I like the rationale because to me it takes us to the space of Audi Adram Badram rule. Every both parties must be heard. That's just basically the rules of natural justice. So I get a sense that you guys know where you're going, you're smart, but sometimes these issues, there's still a few gaps that I'm raising or concerns I want you to address. But I must commend you for the good work you're doing as far, of course. And, let me leave it there, Jefferson. Those three issues I've raised for now until I hear responses. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, sir. Honorable Papa, be the next. But I just want to clarify, honorable members, that we've received the briefing or the presentation. All that we're doing now at this stage is to ask questions for clarity. Yes. You don't put your position to the department.
No.
It is us that are going to deliberate. Yes. And pass the act. So if there's a proposal of extending the 30 days by 5, you don't say yes now. You don't agree with that. You don't have to tell the department that you don't agree. It's not the department is putting a proposal, but you must clarify the department. Your question should be: it must clarify the rationale behind the extension. You're not then supposed to be saying, "Oh, I don't agree." That time is still coming when we'll be deliberating as members. Now it will be up to the members to deliberate on those issues. I just wanted to clarify that. The question that we must be asking must be questions of clarity, not putting our positions for now. Honorable Fab.
Thank you, Chairperson. To our new member, I just heard that he's a member, so a member in progress, I'm not sure. But Chairperson, I would just like to know on the point that we were on the secret ballots. So there was going to be a second secret ballot. I would like to know what the rationale is if there's a second secret ballot, and that the workers can still strike after the second secret ballot. Because I mean, the secret ballot is then the outcome. So now they can go on for after the second secret ballot, they can keep on with the strike. So isn't this unfair towards the, can it not cripple a company, for instance, and shouldn't there be a type of a protection at least in place for the companies as well? As employees, and I mean, we've got good faith bargaining, I understand that part, but in good faith bargaining, it must also be good faith bargaining to the other side, not just for the worker side, because we've seen with the unions, negotiating, we've seen it in Parliament, where you know, it just keeps on, eventually something has to give, but I mean, obviously it is protecting the workers, right, but now you've got like you've got the second secret one. Can you perhaps just lead us on that? Why then after a second secret vote, the first one doesn't work? Thank you, Chair.
Honorable Dekhale, and the last person will be Honorable Chairman.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Let me welcome the presentation. It was loud and clear, though it's confusing. I've been confused when it comes to the farm workers. That's where I want to base. I don't know whether it will be a comment or a question. I am from a deep rural area next to the Z2 farmer. I believe you know it. They deal with tomatoes. And that is a very big farm whereby many people are employed from our villages. And those people, babereka ka di stock. And if you did not work well, or maybe you were like tired that day, and you didn't manage to fill up the bottle with tomatoes, you're not going to get a salary. And now I hear that the farmers here are excluded. My question is why? And I don't even know if ever the department do sometimes visit where these people are sleeping, because they just put in the stones and put a big piece of a wood whereby they come with either one blanket or two. They work very hard during the day and they sleep on that type of a bed. And at the end of the day, the farmers are not covered with this 20 rand per hour. I don't know if ever I did not understand well, then I will need clarity. Another question, I did not hear the department giving us an example of these ones who are working at the funeral palace, because that's where they are saying you earn through the commission you have collected. If ever I manage to recruit three people and they pay a premium of 180 per person, then I get all those 8 rands as a one-off payment. I don't know whether they are also going to be covered on that one, or they are going to continue earning those salaries per profit. Thank you very much.
Before the last question, I'm told that there's tea and coffee outside for everybody. You can grab a cup and come back, and but we'll continue with the meeting. The last speaker, Honorable Mkhebe.
Noche, the presentation was quite explicit, but I think just want to determine the regulations that are going to govern the exclusions. Wasn't there a call to probably have a total overhaul of the provisions of the exclusion mechanism? And I'll explain later why I think that could have been part of the reasons. We have seen also in the recent past that though our law is very explicit about enforcement, but enforcement has been responded to by the employers more often than not by litigation, which is quite exhausting both in resources but also emotionally to the workers. In this particular process, how do we seek to, again, the other thing, in the recent past, Chair would remember, when we were in one of the provinces in Free State, there was an issue which explicitly the department illustrated that there was some sort of a lack of warm body resources to respond to the issues of enforcement. How are we going to deal with it in this case, moving forward? The issue of the dispute resolution mechanism, wasn't there probably a call for a total overhaul of the dispute resolution mechanism? Because I will also explain later why majority of the times this has failed. You would remember that the period between 2012 or something like that, even the Section 150 of the Labor Relations Act was employed, but it could not bring about industrial peace and stability that is so much needed in the industry. The Section 1 of the National Minimum Wage, Section 6 of Section 6 clause, talks about the staggering approach of the domestic workers, farm workers, and the EPWP. What informs the staggering approach? This shifting from the labor court process to the CCMA so that there can be an arbitration award, does it include conciliation? And what are the time frames for conciliation before you zoom into arbitration? We all know, and you have also said it in your presentation, that arbitration awards in their own right, they are challengeable before court. how are we going to ensure that justice delayed is not justice denied to workers? We know. And you have also said if the worker opts to go to the CCMA directly without coming to the department cannot later on join in the litigation process in court. Therefore, if later on the judgment says no, the cost should be bet by the employee, I mean, are we not creating an issue for vulnerable workers? The issue of the warm body resources in your department, have you looked into this? I have already said about the Section 150 of the LRA. In the past, and I want to link it to the peace accord, in the past, you know, Dr. Kalipi, that there has been attempts from the department to bring about different parties to the table through Section 150 to negotiate in public interest, but also to come to a conclusion. And there has been instances where this has not been done, explicitly because parties could not come closer to each other. In this case, what are we going to do different? Because I understand there can be an issue, and you know, for time immemorial, the issue of balloting and picketing has always been a contested terrain. I can tell you now, if, and there's been mechanism already in the Labor Relations Act about picketing, but the employer, as you correctly said, they want the employees far away so that they can bring scape labor, and the employees want to be closer so that they can ensure that there's no scape labor. In this case, what are we going to do? I hear you saying there's going to be an engagement between the employees and the employer. But this mechanism has always been there, and there's been instances where the employer and employee has not been able to find each other. This one says you can't strike here within 100 meters. The other one says this is my area of work. I'm going to strike here. And that caused major disruptions in the industry, but also casualties in the process. And the department is not coming closer as to what is it this time that we're going to be doing different. The peace accord, you know, Dr. Mkalipi, since 2012, there are trade unions that have never been able to sign peace accord. And they go, they become part of the process, they go with the flow, but they will not attach their signature to the peace accord. And therefore, the peace accord is not enforceable. And this is going to bring about issues that are not going to gel well. But I want to applaud you. In a tricameral process like NetLeg, where you are able to extend the quantum leap of faith to each other, find each other, and come with such a process, it's quite encouraging. However, there are sticky issues that has always been there, like your secret ballot, your balloting, your picketing, the issues of litigation, enforcement, that are not coming out explicit. How are we going to arrest them? Thank you, sir.
Raised by Honorable Makwe. I have to clarify this 30-day period, because there could be an assumption that the 30 days start when the commissioner deal with the matter. There could be that assumption now, just judging from his question, and therefore he thinks therefore that 30 days is enough for the commissioner to consider. But also linked to the extension of this 30 days by 5 days. As to that, the application by the commissioner should go to the director. Wouldn't that be too much for the director to consider those extension applications? Shouldn't it be perhaps be at the level of a senior commissioner to approve such application rather than the director? But also the question that he also asked is with regard to the exemption criteria. Would that include the disclosure by the the workplace on the issue of affordability, or would that be in the regulations themselves? Thank you.
Chair, the issue of by Honorable Sanga on, not sure whether it's advisory or voluntary, but I deal with both of them. Now, the issue of, first, the law excludes voluntary workers who volunteer. Now, there are many workers who volunteer during the World Cup. There are workers who volunteer to assist, make sure that the country is able to deliver on the World Cup. Those workers were paid a stipend. They were not employed by the World Cup organizing committee. They were volunteers. There are many people who volunteer to go and wash dogs at FPCA because they are animal lovers. They don't expect to be paid. They volunteer. There are many people who volunteer as a police reservist, who got jobs somewhere else, who work somewhere else, but because of their commitment to policing, they volunteer to do work for the police. That's what the exclusion is talking about. We're not talking about people. Remember, that section says workers who did not expect to be paid. When a worker says, well, I was expected to be paid, and the employer says you are a volunteer, then that worker is not a volunteer because he or she expected to be paid in terms of the law. And therefore, that is a worker. That's a difference. Now, on the advisory, on the LRA advisory arbitration, it's an advisory arbitration. It advises the parties. It says to the parties, as an expert commissioner, I've looked at this. This is what the company can afford. I'm advising you to accept my decision. That's what it says. And the reason is not compulsory. It's because in terms of the constitution of this country, the right to strike is a constitutional right. Now, if you make an arbitration award compulsory, you are interfering with that constitutional right. And that law tend to be rejected by the Constitutional Court if you do that. And that's the advice that we, legal advice, we look at all of these permutations, and the legal advice we got was that don't go that route. Don't have compulsory arbitration on this issue because you'll be then infringing the right to strike in terms of the Constitution. Now, on the issue of compliance, I mean, as you said, I've raised the issue. We're having discussion with National Treasury to ensure that our government procurement processes deal with those employers who got tenders with government but not comply with the minimum wage. That's another enforcement process. That's a compliance process that we're introducing. We're saying in the Employment Equity Act, the law, the bill that is not yet finish at NetLink. We're debating it. We're going to finish it. I'm sure two meetings to finish it. It's going to be here in Parliament before the end of this year. One of the proposals that we're proposing there is because the Act says that Section 53 presence of the Act says if a company does not comply with the Employment Equity Act, does not have a certificate of compliance, that company should not be able to do business with government. Therefore, it can't tender if it does not comply with the Employment Equity Act. And we're saying, in the certificate, the minister can't just look at the Employment Equity Act. The minister must look at the Employment Equity Act and whether the company has no case on non-compliance with the minimum wage at the CCMA or in the labor court that has been decided, so that it can be taken into consideration also. That assists with compliance. The issues around about the fines that we're talking about, where we encourage workers to be to come forward and report cases because we say the fines that the penalties that are awarded to companies are going into their pockets. Precisely, members, because we accept and realize that We are not going to be able to put an inspector in each and every sector. We're not going to have money. The country's already got 50 billion hold that they need to close. It's going to be difficult to go and get extra finance to employ inspectors. We've got to use the resources that we have wisely and properly. And we want to use the millions of workers who are there. We even want to use business, because it's not in the interest of business that my competitor must outbeat me in business because they can pay less. Therefore, business must, if they know that their competitors are not complying with the minimum wage, encourage them to come forward. And those are the processes that we're setting up about compliance. The issue of labor hire and NGOs. The Employment Services Act deals with employment services and the issues about labor hire and that, not the BCA. The BCA doesn't deal with that. Minimum wage doesn't deal with that. But anybody who operates in that space of Employment Services Act has got to be registered, and it's about placement. And workers should not be disadvantaged. Because you are placed by an NGO, doesn't mean that you should not be paid 20 rand. Now, whether the NGOs are doing it in terms of that act, that's a different issue that we need to look in that NGO and see what is it that they are doing and investigate that and act in terms of that act. I'm not going to be able sitting here and say they are doing wrong, but if they prevent employment, because in terms of things in this country, nobody has got the right to say, because I don't stay in Cape Town, I should not be employed in Cape Town. That's an unfair labor practice on its own. You can't prevent me my employment on the basis that I come from Gauteng in terms of the law. And if that information is available, we should be able to take action on those issues. The issue about ticketing and versus Section 17 of the Legal Gatherings Act, the issue about the Constitution having a constitutional right to gather, not to picket. The Constitution doesn't talk about gathering, the picketing, it talks about gathering. You've got a constitutional right to gather. Every constitutional right can be limited. Every constitutional right can be limited. Now, the LRA does limit that right through the requirement of picketing. This is not a new provision of picketing. It has been there already. We're just tightening it up now. Therefore, there's no contradiction between the Gatherings Act, the Constitution, and the picketing provision that we're putting. We're not interfering with the right to strike in putting the provision of the picketing. It's squarely within those provisions of the Constitution and the Gathering Act. Regulation, are they ready? We think we've got two meetings to finalize the regulation at NEDLAC. Nothing prevents this committee, normally under normal circumstances, regulation don't come to Parliament. But nothing prevents this select committee to say to the minister, Minister, this is a very important area. Would want to see those regulations. If the committee says that, we'll definitely bring them here. In terms of our plan, would want the regulation to be finalized by the end of March, beginning April. Because we want employers who say they cannot afford to be able to access those regulations before the 1st of May. Because remember, members, the reason for the regulation is to ensure that it doesn't make sense to put a minimum wage of 20 rand and then you have workers losing their job because the company cannot afford. You've got to balance that. Therefore, the exemption process is to ensure those employers who genuinely cannot afford can be able, instead of retrenching workers, to come to the department and say, guys, hear my books. I cannot afford this because of this reason. We need exemption. In terms of sectoral designation now, employers can apply for exemption. That's what exemption is there for, is to protect jobs. You don't want to introduce a tool that will promise 20 rand but deliver unemployment. We don't want that. Well, the issue of coming to Parliament is in your hands, members. The process of appointing the commissioners, we already started with that. The commissioners The minister will finalize that process well before the 1st of May. By the 1st of May, in fact, by March, they'll receive letters of appointment. But they can only operate after the 1st of May when the law is passed by Parliament. But that process is well underway. We work on that. And as I've indicated, the commissioner are going to start work on the 1st of May. And we are confident about that. No, we're talking about the minimum wage commissioner who will review the commission start on the 1st of May. The issue of education of workers so that workers should know their rights is important. We started that process now. We can't wait for the 1st of May. We've had information sharing with workers all over the province, all provinces, the last process we had was in Kimberley, in Upington, where we indicate to workers what the law says, what are the options, give them the same presentation that we're giving to members here, and answering all the questions so that workers know by now, by the 1st of May, what the rights are in terms of this issue. And going forward, there's no doubt that we still have got to continue. We want even to have discussion with the National Professional Soccer League, the soccer guys. We want to have a discussion with FARU, the rugby guys. We want the New London School, can they give us free advert? That's where we put in the statement that says minimum wage is 20 rand. Anybody who's not paid minimum wage, this is what you need to do. That marketing, that kind of marketing, because I swear, it's not only the people who are at the stadium, it's the people who are at home, who are seeing the match through TV, but all of those issues will depend whether the guys that are in charge here, can they give something back to society? Because remember, the more companies pay the minimum wage, the more people can afford to go to the stadium, to go and pay, therefore it makes business for them also. Those are kind of processes that we want to put in place in order to ensure that we are able to market the national minimum wage properly. The criteria for exemption, it comes back on the issue that we raised. In terms of the law as it stands now, honorable member, there's one criteria for exemption. Can you afford or you can afford? But obviously then, you need, how do you show that you cannot afford? What is it that we require? You can't just phone us and tell us that you cannot afford. What is it that we ask? What information that we need in order to determine that you cannot afford? The regulation will be dealing with that, and that's why we're saying, if the select committee asks for the regulation, for us to come and brief you on the regulation, so that you can be confident that when you go to your constituency and talk about the minimum wage, that the exemption processes are not going to erode the minimum wage. At the same time, the minimum wage is not going to take people out of employment. And the only way of you to have that information is if we come here and take you through the regulation. The issue about the extension of the 30 days, remember this thing. Conciliation is about parties raising, attempting to persuade parties to reach an agreement and settle a dispute. That's what it's all about. Now, what we're saying presently, without any changes, parties can extend by agreement the 30 days. They can extend the 30 days by agreement. But what we're saying is that if, let us say, the commissioner believes that the party are so close to a settlement, and the commissioner needs maybe another hour just to deal with the issue, or 5 hours. Now it's just midnight. Presently, if 12 minutes hit, the commissioner must issue a certificate. Even if the commissioner believes that given more time, we can settle this. Just even an hour or two to one more day, we can settle this. We think the parties are close to each other. Now, what we're saying, because this is about settlement, if the commissioner believes that, this is not a compulsory extension, it's when the commissioner, in his heart, sincerely believes that the parties are close, we need just a little bit of time to push them on. Shouldn't then the commission, not the parties, maybe the parties don't, the one party doesn't agree, the other want to settle. Let's say the employer says, guys, this is the 30th day. Can you give us an opportunity tomorrow just to go to our COO and put this issue? We think that we can have a deal here. And the other party says, no, we're not prepared to do that. And the commissioner evaluates this and says, guys, we're saying that just give them that chance that it's not, instead of giving them a certificate. That's what it's intended. It's intended to encourage settlement. It's not a cut up lunch extension of the 30 days to 35 days. That's not what it's intended. It's intended to ensure that you don't miss an opportunity to settle a dispute, because that's what is important, that dispute must be settled without going through industrial action. And the 30 days, most of the time, the commissioner does not conciliate for 30 days, Chair. That time of 30 days is a time when the dispute arrives at the CCMA. The system may do its administration process. You must find that the commissioner only starts working as conciliating on the 20th day. And that's what the practical activity that takes place in terms of this issue. Honorable Father, on the issue of secret ballot and the two secret ballot, I need to explain this. The first secret ballot is that before you go on strike, workers must have had a secret ballot that says, we want to go and thrive. That's clear. That's what the law presently says. The only difference that we are changing there is that we're saying that the constitution of the union must make sure that when we talk about a secret ballot, we mean a secret ballot. We mean a secret ballot that is secret, that is democratic, and that is fair. And that's what it says. Therefore, the constitution of the union has got to detail those. If it does not have that, it would not be complying with the law. Now, the second thing we're saying that if your strike is violent, then the minister approach the CCMA and say, let us have an arbitration, advisory arbitration here, to try and give advice to this party. And then the commissioner giving us an advice and say, the company wants to give 4% increase, the union wants 15%, the arbitrator says, we're giving 8%. And if the employer does says that we don't accept the 8%, they are given 7 days to decide. On the fifth day, what has been agreed in terms of the law, the minister must publish the arbitration award, because we want to use public pressure on the party. We want to be able to say, this is the best employer. Look how bad it is. An independent commissioner says they can afford, they look on their books, they can afford 8%, but they say they're not prepared to pay. We want to say the same with the union, say this is the bad union. This union is not interested in the interest of its members. This company, the arbitrator says, this company cannot afford what they are asking. If they get what they are asking, workers are going to be unemployed. We publish it in the public so that we want all of you to put pressure on them, because it's going to affect you to put public pressure, because all about public pressure, that's what the publication is about. Then after 7 days, the union must indicate whether they accept that award or not. And then the law says that you don't want the general secretary of the union to say, we reject you. That's not the decision. The law says you must ballot your members. That's the second ballot. You must then take that award that you given by the arbitrator. The arbitrator will draft also a ballot paper where the question that will be asked to members, do you accept the 8% that the arbitrator says the company can afford or not. And that's the secret ballot that the second secret ballot that we're talking about. Now, on the issue of people who get paid on commission, honorable member, in the tomato factory, that too. And any other employee who pays at a commission, or any other employee, it doesn't matter how you get paid. If you got paid by piecework, you work in the farm, they say pick up the bottles, you don't pick up the bottles, you pay 20 rand an hour. Doesn't matter. At the end of that, 20 rand, whether you don't deliver, whether, if you're a farmer, remember, the agreement here is that 20 rand applies to everybody else, but to farmers it's 18 rand per hour. That's what it is, 18 rand. and that 18 rand is for 2 years. In the next 2 years, the commission must come with a recommendation to Netlink to indicate whether farmers can go to 20 rand. It's giving them a leeway for 2 years. But they've got a minimum wage. Not that they're excluded. Their minimum wage is 18 rand. Domestic workers have got a minimum wage of 15 rand. Therefore, in the farming sector, in that situation, 18 rand would be the price that the employer pays, whether the employee produce or doesn't produce, if they pay by commission. Now, the issue of whether an employee produces is a management issue. Management must make sure when I'm employed in the department and the department does not manage me properly and I don't produce, that's a management issue. Then they must deal with me, either disciplinary process, whatever they need to take. But they can't say, because we've asked you to move 20 bottles and you move 10, therefore we'll pay you 10 rand, not 18 rand. They can't do that in terms of the law. It's got to be the minimum wage, whether that minimum wage is for the farms or what. Now, the rationale, the reason for having this different minimum wage for farms, domestic, and the rest, is precisely we want to protect jobs. As I indicated, members, that you don't want to put a minimum wage that will be putting people out of employment, because there's no vulnerable person than a person who's unemployed. If you're unemployed, you're more vulnerable than anybody else. That's the only rationale. We worried that if we say 20 rand in the domestic and the farm and the EPWP, there's no doubt. If you say 20 rand, 50% of the people working in EWTP will lose their job. No doubt. This guy's not going to afford that. There's no doubt about that. And that's the only reason. As I've said, that it's the minimum wage and the protection of jobs. The funeral parlors, doesn't matter. They are workers. If you are a worker, you don't have, to pray that more people must die for you to get the pay. That's what it means. Now, in terms of this, they are workers, the 20 rand apply. Whether people don't die or not, if the employer says, well, because people are not dying, I don't need your service, there's Section 189 of the LRA. They can then start the retrenchment process and all of those issues. But if workers, people are employed, it's got nothing to do with the production level that they need to do. They've got to be paid the minimum wage. The issue of exemption regulation, I think I've dealt with them. The issue of capacity of the department, I've dealt with that issue also. The overall of the dispute mechanism, there's no doubt that the honorable member that our legislation, all our labor legislation, has got the premise that there will be matured, good faith negotiation between the parties. And also our legislation are made with the assumption that you will have strong and trade unions and a strong employer organization. Now, that apple cart has been disturbed in the last 5-10 years. Trade unions, you've got many trade unions that have been registered, many trade unions who represent lesser workers. And the competition among trade unions is rough. They might be fighting for socialism, but the competition, capitalism among themselves, is rife. They're fighting for membership. As a result of that, it affects their ability to enter into deals. Because if they sign an agreement, they are afraid that this other union will come and organize these members and say, if it was us, we would have taken it to strike, we would not have signed that agreement, and promised them heaven and earth. And that's the issue about not only dispute resolution, collective bargaining. Therefore, we've got a very big steps that we need to take, all of us, to ensure that we rebuild the trust in collective bargaining. There's no doubt about that. The code that we talk about is starting that process. And it deals with how parties should conduct themselves. And it's going to take a longer time, honorable member. You're not going to be able to have a legislation that changes attitude. Because This is not about it. This is about attitude, how people see things and how people behave. It's a behavioral change that we need to take. It's going to take time. We've got to work on it. And the first step is the code and taking parties through the code and trying to assist them in there. I've explained the rationale for the exclusion of the farms and domestic. I'm not going to repeat that. The issue about review, how are we going to ensure that employers don't frustrate workers and the implementation of the minimum wage through application of reviews? Remember, in the last act, we made the LRA indicate that if you're going to ask for a review, if a company asks for the review, must put security. We've got to make sure that the court enforces that provision. That provision of security was intended to ensure that only genuine reviews come for. You don't want to stop companies asking for a review because sometimes it's a genuine legal issue that will enrich the labor relation processes in the country. Therefore, you can't stop court processes altogether. But you should make, we're trying to make sure that it's not a court process just to frustrate the process. And the best that you can do is to ensure that the security provision in the LRA are adhered to. But you can't, in terms of the rule of law, prevent anybody applying for a review. We hope, looking at the experience of the bargaining council processes, where not a single case on enforcement, not talking about dismissal disputes, I'm talking about enforcement of agreements, has gone to the labor court. Where the bargaining council has issued an arbitration award, there's been compliance. We're hoping here, even if we don't got 100% of the team, if we can increase that and have only about 10%, 20% going through arbitration, that would be a big improvement. It would mean that you have 80% compliance after the CCMA processes. The picketing and what if there's no agreement and the support. Remember what we're saying is that in terms of this bill, when you look at the bill, you will see there's what we call default picketing rules. Therefore, there's no chance that there will ever be no agreement on picketing. There would be a picketing rule because there's default picketing rules that will be published. What is going to happen is that when an applicant, which almost is a union that applies to the CMA, employers don't apply to the CMA, they are more responsive. When the union applies, then the union must do two things. The union can say to the CMA, we've already got a picketing agreement. Because other companies already have the standard picketing agreement, and then they submit to that. Then the commissioner doesn't have to do anything. If they don't have the picketing agreement, then they must supply that information that we are asking, the number, where the distance, who's going to be contacted if things go wrong, and all of those issues, supply that. And when the commissioner then consolidates the dispute, they are going to download the default picketing rules that are published in terms of the regulation of the LRA. And those the default picketing rules, then the commissioner is just going to put the information and say, well, the employer wants you to be 500 meters away from the company. The union wants to be in the middle of the company. Then the commissioner must decide what is fair. If the commissioner says, well, the thing is fair is about 200 meters away from the company, then that's what the commissioner will put on the default application and put all the information. Then the commissioner, at the end of the process, if the process is not resolved, then the commissioner gives parties a certificate, gold strike, and a picketing rule. Commissioner will not be allowed by law to give a certificate without picketing rule. They've got to give the two. If they don't give picketing rule, then they must be dismissed as commissioner because the law requires that, without limiting the right to strike. If the employer does not respond, give the information, then the commissioner must assume that the employer agrees with the information supplied by the union. If the union does not supply the information, that form application is not competent. That dispute cannot be dealt with. And they can't give a certificate. Therefore, they can still go on strike. As you know, members, the right to strike is a constitutional right. But protection is not a constitutional right. Therefore, if you go to strike without a certificate, you don't have protection. workplace doesn't mean that you can't go to class. Therefore, that's where the issue comes in. If the union does not supply the information, there will be no protection. If the employer does not supply the information, the commissioner will take the information in front of him or her and issue the certificate on the basis of that, and they must take the consequences.
The decision of the commissioner on the picketing rules, let's say the issue of distance, for example, is it compulsory? What I'm trying to say, I'm anticipating a situation where the dispute just on the picketing rules, where the decision of the commissioner is to be reviewed, whether that won't delay the strike itself, if you were to start with the strike, but then you have a dispute around the decision of the commissioner, if you can clarify that, or the decision of the commissioner is final.
Well, I mean, all decisions of commissioners are reviewable. Obviously, if the decision of the commissioner is so outrageous, so unbelievable, then that commissioner will be challenged. But if the decision is within the norm of the dispute itself, because remember, even the conciliation itself can be challenged. The issue, even if, let's take out the picketing rule, if the commissioner issues a certificate, nothing prevents the party interdicting the commissioner and saying that certificate should not be issued for whatever reason. Therefore, it doesn't necessarily mean that because now you're introducing picketing, you're delaying the strike, because the strike can be interdicted as it is now. And presently, in law, the CCMA is responsible to issue picketing rules, even now. The only difference that is done, we have not changed that, is still the responsibility of the CCMA. If parties can't agree, the CCMA must give them picketing rules. But what happening present now is that they get a certificate, then get picketing rules 2 weeks later, and we're stopping that. We say picketing rules must go hand in hand with a certificate. Whether they are going to be challenged, that's what part of the process that they can be challenged even now without introducing this provision. Therefore, we can't stop the challenge, but so far, we have not had court cases that challenge decision of the CCMA on picketing rules. When the CCMA gave picketing rules, all those picketing rules have been accepted and have been applied. We don't foresee any change to that. As I said, the only difference is that they come up front now instead of after the certificate. The issue about are we putting too much on the director on the 30 days, when we ask that the commissioner must ask the director, it could be that you're putting too much, but the balancing act that you're making here is that you don't want a lazy commissioner. Every time they have a conciliation, they extend the 30 days. That's why we're taking it out of the process. The commissioner must go to the director and tell the director why the process must be extended and say to the director, these are the reasons we think we're close here, and the director must consider that quickly. And they must walk to the director, or they must phone the director and indicate, precisely because you don't want to make this a norm and let commissioners extend processes as a matter of course. I've dealt with all the questions.
Just allow us for those areas that members want to further clarity on. I have said one of them, the BCA, the issues of payment, and also the minimum wage and the collective agreement were matters that were dealt with by the Department of Labor. In terms of the capacity of the CCMA, are you going to deal with that capacity in terms of perhaps giving them more money so that they employ more commissioners? Because now you're adding the work that was done by the department to CCMA. But secondly, will you have, in CCMA itself, will there be commissioners who are that dedicated to deal with the issues of BCA, the payment part of it, as well as the National Minimum Wage and Collective? Honorable Ntebe, and then Honorable Honorable, before you answer my question, there's another follow-up. And Honorable Dekhale.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I know it's going to take long minutes.
Okay.
My apology, Honorable Intel. Thank you very much. Chairperson, then we have a lot of work to do. This bill is not like other any bills, whereby when it comes to the issue of public hearing, we can just touch here and there. We need to make sure that we take time to go to the farmers and address the workers and even their employers. And we need to also consider, I know this area normally, when we do our public hearings, we normally don't consider. We need to consider this time going to the traditional areas and where they have their chorus and talk to their people so that they have the knowledge of this bill. Otherwise, my presenter, people are suffering out there. They are suffering because they don't have knowledge of all these things. That's my request, actually, to my chairperson and the department. Thanks. And even the radio interviews.
Okay, thanks. Honorable Ntebe.
Chair, I want to argue that Ntate Mkhalipi came very close to addressing the majority of the... I mean, the staggering approach, you are quite clear about what informs. I mean, it's a delicate balance between job security versus the creation of and maintenance of industrial peace and all that. I think you came very close to doing that. But I think you also agree partly that our trajectory in terms of the labor relations framework seeks to bring about stability but also create a conducive environment moving into the future. And this is just but one part of going into that future. However, you did not address the issue that I was raising in relation to the picketing rules and the balloting. The issue is not about whether there should be picketing or not. It's about contestation of legalities of about how the modalities of picketing. And you agreed to it earlier on, to say it has always, and in the past, matured industries with collective agreements that are quite matured have always had in their collective agreements picketing rules infused into that. But the issue is about compliance to the picketing rules. And you know, it has always been a contested terrain. The commissioner would say, I'm reaching a delicate balance, you must stay 250 meters away. The employer wanted it to be 500 meters away. But there will be no compliance to that. And that leads to confrontation. And confrontation disturbs industrial peace that we want to secure in terms of the policy framework. So those are the things that probably the amendment came very short in addressing them. The issues of the peace accord, it's not probably addressing the issues that we need to see from the industry. Because, as you say, the law says we must encourage the non-proliferation of trade unions. But it is happening. It's a reality. And those things cause confrontation from employer-employee relationship, which is riddled with confrontation in its inherent nature, but also between intra-union rivalry. It's there. And this, I know that it might be one of the processes moving in the future, but it's coming very short of addressing pertinent issues. Confrontational issues are not addressed. Yes, you can picket, but where do you picket? And what do you do when there's no compliance? And we know that in the past, there has not been compliance. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Chair. I'll respond to the matter that has been raised by Honorable Dekhal when we outlined the way forward. But the council can respond to that follow-up question.
The issue of the CCMA and the system have capacity. Well, all of us in government, we are told by the guys that are holding the purse, all government and SOEs, my boss here tells me, say, you've got to use what you've got smarter. The chances of extra funding are very limited. But the SMA has been given extra funding. It's the only organization in the department that has got extra funding, precisely because of this. You will see, I'm sure, when the minister tomorrow introduces the budget. It's one organization in the family. But secondly, is that on the issue of capacity of commissioners, remember, CCMA commissioners are also commissioners in Birmingham Council, part-time commissioners. They work on this work. They determine wages and working conditions, minimum wages in Birmingham Council. Therefore, it's nothing new in terms of that. You're not going to have commissioner for BCA for this. You are going to have as many commissioners as possible who are able to implement the minimum wage and the regulation in terms of the department. And remember, we say to our inspectors, there are two things. Inspectors must attempt to get the first prize in undertaking. Remember, an undertaking is a promise. The employer says, yes, I agree that I did not comply with the law. I'm gonna correct that. And if then the employer does not correct that, it's an agreement. That's an agreement. It's easy then to go to the CMA and say, yes, the employer signed. Yes, agreed. And on the hand, come to the CMA and say, no, I don't agree now anymore. That's not how it works. They've agreed. It's an agreement. Go to the CMA. It's going to be easy. Therefore, those inspectors that get undertaking, it's going to be easy. Even inspector write a compliance order properly. For me, it's about proper writing it properly. It's going to be easy for the CMA to make those decisions and decide on those. Therefore, we don't think that this is going to be a complex area. As long as our inspectors write the documentation that go to the CMA clearly and precise, so that when the commissioner look at it, says the employer, you have not paid the minimum wage, you should have paid 20 rand, you pay this, that's a pay slip, the worker says that, and this is what, and the employer doesn't have a leg to stand on in that case. There's no long argument because they have not paid. So either you pay or you don't. And then for us, that's how we see it. We think it's going to work out. Well, on the issue of, I repeat again, honorable member, this is changing attitude, behavior. Changing behavior is not easy. That's what the code of good practice is trying to do. All the issues that they are raising, because the code of good practice talks on the conduct of the parties in the labor market. It says what is best conduct, what is, and what we intend to do, honorable member. We intend the CCMA, we said to the CCMA, because the CCMA has got the responsibility of training all workers in this country. We say the code must be Bible, it must be the Quran, it must be, what is it for the Jewish community, what is it called? It must be that of the labor market. And we must train all our workers on what the code says. If we do that, it will assist in the issues that they are raising in changing behavior. And you are not going to have a law that changes behavior. It doesn't matter what laws that you pass. If you don't work on the behavior of a party, you are not going to change attitudes. And that's what the code is intended to do. Through training, through engagement, over a long period. And we think we are in for a long haul to do that.
So that I'm democratic enough, I just want to check if any other questions. Oh. All right. Now then, honorable members, in terms of the way forward, as that was indicating earlier, that bill, private members' bill, which we will deal separately from the one that the Acting DG and Mr. Mkhalipi has referred for, that we
Chair, on a point of procedure. We have so many of them. It helps, Chair, if you maybe mention the B number, like B29, 2017. Just so that we are all together, because we're taking a decision on the matter, Chair.
About the PMB 5 of 2015.
Yeah, the first one is the
what we're going to do now, but this week we're going to issue out an advert for submission. But the advice that we have received is that we should advertise in the national newspapers, but also particularly with the 29, 30, and 31. We should also be sending the letters in writing stakeholders, especially, you know, there are some stakeholders who are not necessarily participating at the level of NEDLAC. But when we read the papers, we have seen their comments on some of these issues. So we'll give them opportunity, one, by advertising in the national newspaper, two, by writing directly to them and inform them that as a committee, we are considering this bill, so that if they so wish, they can make their written submission, but also invite them at a later stage for the oral presentation submission. So that is going to be the process. But because also, as I indicated earlier, because also the National Assembly Portfolio Committee is doing the same. We will, from time to time, wait for them to complete some of these processes, so that if there are any amendments, we can also consider the amendments that they are made. At some stage, we will have to then wait for them to take this bill to the chamber, so that the chamber passes the legislation. And thereafter, then they are sent to us, and then we deliberate on them, especially this one of the 29, 30, and 31. But we will deal with the B25 in the same way, because it has already been passed in the National Assembly. Honorable Faber.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, I don't want to say that I don't agree with you, but what I do want to say on Section 75 bills,
it is the prerogative of the National Assembly, not the NCOP. As soon as it becomes 76 bills, we take over by going into the provinces, by advertising, etc. At this stage, from what I understand, this is a process from the National Assembly, not the NCOP. If I'm wrong, please just show me in the rules or wherever where that is, that I can be brought up to date on that. Because as far as I'm, the knowledge that I've got, maybe I don't have enough on that. But from what I understand, it is the National Assembly Portfolio Committee that handles that part on the Section 75 bills, and we get involved as soon as it's on 76 bills. If you can just clarify that and show me on it, please, Chair.
I think there are a lot of people that want to clarify. Let me leave it to them. Honorable Makuwe, Honorable Dihari.
Chairperson, I'm looking at the Constitution and thought that it may just help if I read that clause. Section 75. In bracket 1 says, when the National Assembly passes a bill other than a bill to which the procedures set out in Section 74 or Section 76 applies, the bill must be referred to the National Council of Provinces and dealt with in accordance with the following procedure. A, the Council must, 1, pass the bill, 2, pass the bill subject to amendments proposed by it, or 3, reject the bill. If, and then B, final one, Chair, if the Council passes the bill without proposing amendments, the bill must be submitted to the President for assent.
Let me just clarify then the processes. What's going to happen, which is has happened with the private members' bill, the UIF, the one that Honorable Dudley was talking about. It's Section 75. It has been passed by the National Assembly, and now it's referred to us. The process of referring it to us starts with the briefing, which we've just received. And then the second process is that then we must advertise. A very similar process that the portfolio committee deals with must advertise, because we are a separate house. We must advertise and invite submissions, written submissions. We will consider a written submission, but also invite those who want to. There will be those who are satisfied with sending their written submission. They may not necessarily want to come and make an oral submission. Let me make an example about ARTO. ARTO bill was passed by the National Assembly, and then it was referred to the Select Committee on Economic and Business Bureau. You remember, Honorable Fabo, when we had the first meeting, because the Department of Transport sent the director, there was an objection from them, because you wanted either the minister or the deputy minister or the DG to be present. So they were not allowed to present the ARTO bill. And then we had to reschedule the meeting. In that meeting, then the DG was present and also the CEO of the RTI. They made a presentation. That one, the difference is that it was 76. I mean 76. But I can make other examples of Section 75. Even the unemployment insurance bill itself, which is 75. That's why they're saying that even after we passed it as a NCOP, but then in when they were drafting now the final act, then there were mistakes that were errors in the final act. That was, I don't know, it was already signed by the president. It was already signed, but it was discovered that there were errors. And then they had to then use this unemployment, the private members, to correct those errors. That's what the minister was, reporting on. But the process that we followed when we were passing that legislation, it started in the National Assembly as the Section 75 bill.
the first the committee. The committee dealt with all the processes, including the public hearing, going to the provinces and all that for the Section 7. Now, then when it came to us, we also got a briefing from the Department of Labor. We received that briefing, and then we advertised for submissions. There were submissions that we considered, but also we invited those who made submissions if they wanted to make oral presentations. If you remember, I think it was only AFSA. Was it AFSA? It was only AFSA who came and made the oral presentation, and then there were responses to those oral presentations. So it's a similar process. The only difference is that we don't take it to the provinces, to the legislatures, because it's Section 75. And then after those after considering the oral and written submission, we deliberate as a committee and see whether we have amendments to make. If yes, we make those amendments. If not, we pass the Section 75 as it is. And then it will take it to the House, and then the chairperson of the committee then present it to the House, and then the House will vote on it, because it's Section 75. They vote on it individually, and then the bill is passed, and then it goes into the president for assent. So that is the process. So this is going to be the similar process as well with regard to this B25, and also we're going to be having a similar process with B29, 80, and 81. Let me also give an opportunity to the legal services of Parliament. Maybe they can also, in a legal term, assist on this matter.
Thank you, Chair. You 100% spot on. There are two provisions in the Constitution that deal with public participation. So one deals with the National Assembly, and that's Section 59(1)(a). And then Section 72(1)(a) deals with the NCOP, and it reads as follows. The NCOP must facilitate public involvement in the legislative and other processes of the Council and its committees. And you'll see that on a reading of that, it doesn't distinguish between 75 and 76. So regardless of whether 75 or 76, the NCOP will have its own, facilitate its own public involvement process.
Public involvement takes the form of either bringing the parties to Parliament or going to the provinces, either one. You know. But just to respond on the question that was raised by Honorable Tekhale, we think that the process that we will be embarking upon, especially with regard to 29, 30, and 31, is that of advertising on the website, advertising on national newspapers, but also writing to stakeholders, particularly those that are not participating at NEDLA. I mean, the South African Federation of Trade Unions, they are not yet accepted in NEDLA. And perhaps it's affiliates as well. I know NUMSA has been vocal on this issue of minimum wages. We can invite them. But because on this one, there's a the date of implementation of the 1st of May. Even if we take the advantage that we will still have the public involvement, but we won't necessarily go to the provinces. But members who know of a critical stakeholder that should be invited, maybe farm workers association in the communities. You can make us aware of that stakeholder so that we also invite them. So that would be the process as well.
I have a great interest in this bill, and I believe it will also create a greater interest out there in the public. Even if we are not going to go to the provinces. But we can always reach our provinces through the radio interview, using our different language and different radio stations. Eastern Cape, we have a member. Northern Cape, we have a member. Limpopo, we have a member. so that people are aware of it. If the employers know that their people does not know or have knowledge of this thing, they will continue to like treat them as they are treating them.
Just before Honorable Pap, perhaps what normally other Mr. Kalle and the DG, what other department normally do when they introduce these bills? Also within the presentation itself, they also list the stakeholder that you consulted in terms of the public hearing. I don't know if you could maybe at some stage, if you can email us the list of the stakeholders that you consulted in terms of your own public hearing as a department. Honorable Pap.
Thank you, Chair. Chairperson, I really don't disagree that we must also be involved by talking to people about that. That is not my point. The point I'm trying to make is on Section 75 Bill, the National Assembly itself do have public participation already. Then they do the bill on the 75 and it gets sent to us. So the public participation part has already been done. Now what I'm just saying is, now we want to do it again, because we're not taking it to the provinces like the Section 76 bill. So the only problem that I've got, now we want to do the same work again, exactly what the National Assembly has done, to go back to the public again for a second round of public participation. Now, to me, this defies the whole reason why it's been a Section 75 bill. Because on Section 76, we at the NCOP, because it's got to do with our provinces, we go and our provincial legislators go out, speak to the people, we get the information back, and we come because it's got to do with the provinces. Now, on Section 75, the National Assembly Portfolio Committee has already done the public participation and with the department. That's how I got it. My problem that I've got is, if we're going now to the public and we present it to them again and things come back to us, how will we be able now to go back to the National Assembly to do amendments? Because we don't have a mandate from a province. You understand what I'm getting at, to do amendments. I just want to understand, how will we be able to interact with that as from there?
Let me just clarify. I said earlier we were a separate house. The fact that NA has gone through those processes, it doesn't stop us from also, it is a requirement on our plan that we must involve public when we pass bills. We must involve it in the public. When, in our consideration of the bill, if we make amendments, we can make amendments to
them.
And then we must send it back to them so that they also consider those amendments. It's up to them to accept those amendments or not. But then they will pass the fees. That's where the difference is. But if we don't make any amendments, then we take the bill to the House, it's adopted, and then it goes to President. But if we make amendments, it goes back to the National Assembly. But it won't come back to us. It will be up to them to consider the amendments and accept them or not. So that is the process.
We don't have a provincial mandate. This is what I would say.
No. We, as members of parliament, we can also deliver it on our own with regard to section. That's the point. That's why I was saying, Honorable Makwebu should hang on now with regard to his own position on the bill that was being presented. When we deliver it, he can come and say, I don't agree with the 5-day extension. And then if all of us we agree, then we make those amendments. And then those amendments that we don't agree with the 5 days, we limit it to the 30 days. Then it's the amendment that we've made. And that 30 days is the limit, must then go back to the National Assembly. And then the National Assembly must consider it agrees with us that there should be no extension of 5 days. But if they still say no, 5 days is still fine, then they pass it. They don't have to come back to us. Yeah. Not really. Yeah. Sorry, keep on. Honorable, raise his hand before you, but you.
The small request, as usual.
Okay.
With the leadership chairperson, can we not frustrate this bill? Can we make sure that we do everything that will end up assisting the people out there having the knowledge of this bill?
That's why I was outlining the process. That is, this week we're going to issue out an advert to invite stakeholders so that we ensure that there's public involvement. We even go extra mile because we're not even required to write to stakeholders directly and invite them. They have a responsibility to read newspapers. You know, but we have going extra mile by writing directly to them and invite them. But yeah, let me first give to Honorable Chair, because
let's agree that we close. I think we are confusing. The Lamola judgment was quite clear. It places an obligation on the House of Parliament called the MCOP to also satisfy itself in terms of consultation, give audience to the people despite what the National Assembly has done. The only limitation in this case is that we are not required to go down to our provinces for consultation. But members are at liberty to contribute names of potential consultative bodies that we want to have so that we, through your leadership, we can write to them and they come here, raise their view, infuse them if we so agree. If we don't, then pass the bill. But like you are saying, we must then plan backwards. Say this is the 1st of May and backwards. How do we seek to do that? But also Honorable Dikhalo was quite proactive and say, we speak different languages. We might, through your leadership, send to different mediums of communication so that we spread the word. But I think we must go towards finality. Honorable Fava is now influenced otherwise.
Can we conclude now, honourable members, with regard to the issue of the radio station and all that? It's a matter that we will have to discuss with the chairperson of committee, the House chairperson, because it might involve court, because the radio station might want to charge Parliament for that service. So it's a matter, we take it, but it's a matter that we'll raise with the House chairperson of committees so that we given that that request is considered. I'm not taking any more help.
If you could show me once in the last 9 years where that succeeded, I will buy you a BMW.
Can we, let me take this opportunity to thank the department. Perhaps just allow the acting DG if you have any closing remarks. And yeah, and then after that we will release the department and deal with the other internal committee matters before we close the meeting.
Thank you, Chair. Just to say that we appreciate the inputs that were given by the House, and we will surely come back to you on the request that you made, that we need to give you a list of the stakeholders that we have to, you want to engage. Yes. But thanks a lot for your endowment.
Thank you very much. But I'm just also inform again that there's lunch ready, if you can also help yourself. Perhaps what we could do, members, can we just, I don't know, it's up to you whether we break now this and then come back and deal with the internal matter. Baumtag.
No, don't fall in that pressure.
Don't put your stuff with mine, man.
No,
I grab it.
No, this is safe here.
This is safe here.
public holiday is in the middle of the week. Now, the idea of coming on Tuesday for one day, that is only for one day, is a problem. So the wives discussing and indicating that why shouldn't that week rather be considered as a constituency week? That, in terms of the program, then affects the program, because we had indicated that because of the amount of work that we will be dealing with as a committee, we should also consider some Fridays for meeting. We had already then, in terms of this program, suggested that on the 23rd of March, we should have a meeting which will be on Friday. Because there's a possibility that tomorrow in the programming committee meeting, there could be a decision that that week of the 19th is a constituency week. So it means, therefore, that this 23rd of March that is in the program will have to fall off, and then consider the APP of I think Department of Labor, if I'm not mistaken. 20th as well. 20th and the 23rd, the transport and the Department of Labor to other aid. So those are the only issues that we wanted to highlight on the program. But that will also depend on whether tomorrow's programming committee finally decides that week will be a constituency period. Then the issue of the international tribal request that the chairperson of the Select Committee on Trade and International Relations, we can talk to that issue, that update that helps before even we comment on the program, Honorable Mako. Just update us on the underway trip, if there are any updates.
Nothing new, Chair.
On the program itself, any comments? Honorable Nyambo.
Chair, I think if we're consistently using Friday, it must be at least 9 o'clock in the morning, starting Friday, starting time, so that those members want to be free about lunch and be able to do that. But I have no problem using Friday.
We had already agreed last week, but like you say, it could be 9 to 12. And just 2 hours, 9 to 12. Or 2 hours, 9 to 12, yeah. Any other comments? If not, please, I then declare the meeting adjourned till the next date of the meeting. Next week we're supposed to be having a committee planning review, but also in this meeting, which was here, the joint meeting of chairpersons and whips, it was indicated that some provinces, about 3 of them, next week are having a forecast, and then it's going to affect the attendance. KZN, Northern Cape, and Free State are having SOPAS next week. So finally, I think tomorrow, in fact, it was already agreed that those dates have now been deferred to the 7th and 8th of March. So we won't even be able to have a committee because it will also affect attendance even in the committee next week. Thank you very much, ma'am. The staff meeting at 10.
Thank you.